All right, good morning, everyone, and welcome to the review tax structure, the straw proposal stakeholder meeting. We appreciate you being here today. My name is Jody Cross, and I'll be facilitating the meeting. We will be taking questions throughout. So for people that are on the phone or through the web, please press pound 2, and we will get to your question at the appropriate time. So we will, like I said, we are on the straw proposal. So the next draft final, or well, sorry, I'm not even, the stakeholder written comments are due on February 15th. We will post the revised straw proposal at the end of March, after which we will hold another meeting with the stakeholder comments due on that in late April. And then when, for the draft final, we'll obviously let you know that schedule when it's defined. Any questions on that? Yeah, didn't think so. All right, and with that, I will turn it over to Chris Devon.
Is there a clicker thing for this, or do you just do that? Okay.
Morning, everyone. So a couple things. First off, I am getting over a cold, so there may be some lingering symptoms here. So if I am a little bit hoarse and sniffly, I apologize. Hopefully that doesn't impede the meeting too much. Also, we were a bit late in posting our presentation. I just got it posted this morning. I'd like to apologize to stakeholders for that. I know that we try to get those out 2 days ahead of time, but we were making some final revisions through this morning and needed some additional time. So we have printed off of some copies of these in the back of the room for folks that want copies of that. And if there are a need for any more to be printed off, just let one of us know. Oh, yes, thanks. Also, I wanted to note that we are going to be recording today's meeting for other folks to listen to at a later date if necessary. So I just wanted to note that as well, and that will be made available on the ISO's website once we get the recording all finalized. Okay, so with that, thanks for everyone who's attending and on the phone, and let's jump into the slides that we have prepared for today. First, I just want to talk about a little bit of a summary of our objectives and the straw proposal elements, and then we're going to get into some of the other more details on both the major aspects of the proposal. So, I can already tell this might be a rough one with my voice, but I'll do my best. So first off, a little bit of an overview on the tax structure. There's really two primary aspects of the tax structure that we describe in the proposal for potential modification in this iteration. These are the point of measurement, which is currently assessed at the end-use customer meters on gross load. We have considered the TD interface measurement option as an alternative approach suggested by stakeholders, and we have significant discussion on that in the later slides. The other primary aspect is the measurement of customer usage that's used for our billing determinant, which is currently a volumetric measurement approach. And we considered peak demand charges, time of use, and a hybrid blend of volumetric and peak demand approaches for discussion in our straw proposal. And finally, I just want to note that we think it's important to recognize that any of these changes are going to have impacts on the cost allocation of the existing system's embedded costs, and that will probably be a theme that you hear throughout today's discussion. So what are our objectives for some of these TAC modifications that we're proposing and considering today? Throughout this process, we've wanted to stress that we believe that any of these modifications should be designed primarily to reflect the potential of three different possible philosophies or approaches. And after discussion with stakeholders and review of the potential for the efficacy of some of these potential outcomes of some of the philosophies, the two that we really are trying to primarily consider and reflect in this proposal are cost causation and cost drivers of the past and the current use of the system and benefits that are being provided. But the third that we were thinking about, which we described in the proposal, was the potential for adjusting future behavior or impacting or incentivizing future behaviors or incentivizing particular resource decisions or procurement decisions. And that, we think, is one of the principles that we are not proposing to try to accomplish through this proposal. We can discuss that further, but at this point we believe that it's not really an effective tool to try to use the TAC structure to create some kind of incentive or infect behaviors, because we're primarily focused on the way that we want to allocate the cost and recover the cost of the embedded system costs. So the second bullet here, we just wanted to explain that we think that because we have had constant changes to the system over the past 10 years and even prior to that, the transmission system has been planned and used differently and is now evolving. And some of the ways that we had been structured the current rates, the current rate design may not actually align with some of the principles that we were trying to consider here that I just mentioned. So with that, we wanted to recognize that you know, we do know that, and we do recognize that the tax structure may have impact on these procurement decisions, but again wanted to focus on that we think it's primarily important to make sure that we have a fair and reasonable recovery of the existing costs of the system. So how is our proposal for the straw proposal related to these objectives? We believe that the cost recovery mechanism should align cost causation and benefits, and that these proposed changes may better reflect those considerations. And again, we think that, you know, it needs to be done in a simple and understandable manner, and that we'll recover costs in a fair and equitable way. So the changes that we're proposing right now, you know, we think those should only be made if they can be shown to more closely align cost causation and benefits with the way that we're allocating those costs. And then finally, we are very concerned with avoiding creating any kind of signal or incentive that would ultimately have an inefficient impact on market outcomes or dispatch, and we will talk a little bit more about that later as well. So a summary of the major elements of the proposal that I had mentioned, those two aspects, the point of measurement and the measurement of customer use. Just wanted to give you an overview before we jump into them, give you a summary of kind of the major points that we were considering in this decision for these parts of the proposal. So on the point of measurement, the ISO has proposed no change at this time and will continue to utilize end-use customer meter load data. We believe this is appropriate because most stakeholders have supported this element of the proposal, and one of the primary concerns that have been raised is cost-shifting outcomes that may not be justified. We can talk about that a little bit more today, of course, but that was one of the primary concerns that the ISO agreed with. And then also I just wanted to note that we think that if there is some need to adjust the treatment for certain resources or the point of measurement, that there would have to be some other additional rate-making mechanisms needed to ensure these resulting cost shifts were not unreasonable. Some of that stuff may be outside the purview of the ISO, and we can try to describe some of those things a bit more, but that also went into our thinking about this part of the proposal. And then on the measurement of customer use proposal, we are proposing to modify the currently pure volumetric approach and do a hybrid billing determinant approach where we have a part volumetric still and then part peak demand based on our coincident peak gross load. We believe that that will better reflect the current cost and cost drivers and usage and benefits of the transmission system. And so finally, for the wrap up of this objectives and summary of the proposal, I just wanted to note that we think it's really important to keep in mind that both of these aspects of the tax structure are very important to consider holistically. And we think that if you just move the point of measurement to the TD interface without some of those other vital modifications, then that would result in some unjustified cost shifts and then potential for inefficient dispatch of the market that could increase cost for consumers. we discuss that a bit with our MSC members, and so you know there could be some additional work that we do to try to quantify that if we need to provide some more support for our proposal in the future. So we're open to talking about that as well. And then also we wanted to note that the hybrid billing determinant approach we think accurately reflects cost causation and benefits better. Again, I've noted that a bunch of times you know, we think that if we just keep the current volumetric approach, it could exacerbate some of the inefficient market outcomes that some of the folks, including our Department of Market Monitoring, have noted in their feedback. All right, so I'll stop there, see if there's any questions on the previous slides. All right, let's jump into the point of measurement proposal. Okay, so as I just noted, we are proposing to maintain the current point of measurement at the end-use customer meter. We talked about this potential change during potentially change to the TD interface point of measurement during a couple of working groups that we held previously last year and following our issue paper, and then we solicited feedback during those after those discussions. Again, just wanted to note that we had numerous concerns and issues in opposition to use of that, which was one of the major reasons why we made this part of the proposal. And again, the major concern that was raised that we think is very vital to consider here is that potential changes would cause inappropriate cost shifts or at least unjustified cost shifts and may not be considered inappropriate by some, but we think the justification is the part where it could be difficult to justify some of the potential changes there. Because it may not reflect the actual costs that were incurred to meet those needs of each of the UDC areas if we start shifting those costs around in a manner that would be caused by moving to the TD interface and then having additional DG procurement happening in the different UDC areas. So it's really about the existing embedded costs and making sure that those aren't moved around inappropriately. So with that, I wanted to just touch on one of the aspects that we talked about in the proposal a bit, explaining that, you know, we do believe that there are some validity to some of the claims that stakeholders have made related to the benefits and cost causation of that DG resources can impact. But we also wanted to note that we think that even customers served by some DG production are receiving benefit from the transmission system. So, you know, we noted this before, but very few loads that are being served by DG actually really truly leave the grid. You know, you have to be islandable to actually not receive any benefits from the transmission system. So we wanted to note that again and then, you know, make the statement that we believe customers are accessing most or all the benefits of the transmission system, including energy delivery, peak capacity deliverability, and all the other key vital reliability services that were noted in the proposal as well during any given time in normal system conditions, but especially those reliability and capacity functions being delivered during peak and contingency conditions. And then we finally wanted to note on this one that, you know, we think that it's not very easy to quantify some of those potential benefits and note that they're really not proportional to the net energy transferred to or from the transmission grid. So, you know, that part's kind of important because right now the volumetric approach that we use is the proxy for the overall usage of the system, but we think that, you know, while there may be some opportunity to make changes to a hybrid approach, it is still going to be very hard for us to quantify some of those benefits. And, you know, one of the main principles of rate making is that, you know, benefits reflect or roughly commensurate with the cost. and the cost allocation reflects that. So with that, let's keep going on to the next slide. So this is a point that we wanted to make as well to kind of tee things up for our discussion today. We think that it's important to note that DG resources can reduce potential future costs, and we admit to that, agreeing to that point, but it's important to note that we do not believe that the embedded cost of the existing system can be reduced by DG or any kind of other resources. Those costs are sunk. They won't be reduced. And so it's important to note that, you know, we do agree that there could be some future cost avoidance from DG or other type of transmission alternatives, but that really depends on the nature of the particular resource and then the needs of the grid in specific identified locations. And we believe that the current transmission planning process does take into account those things, and we'll talk about that a little bit more. So the point that I wanted to make on that aspect of it is that when we look at those forecasting issues in the transmission planning process, and not only in the transmission planning process, but in like the state forecasting IPER, where it does take into account those kind of DG impacts, and also energy efficiency and DR, those do become part of the transmission plan and investment, and can offset some of the future investment costs. So those investments aren't made and then don't become part of the TAC. So we want to recognize that that is the case here today, and then we can talk a little bit more about what that really means to the proposal. All right. So why is that important to talk about that? We wanted to explain that the embedded costs are incurred to serve customers, and the impacts to the existing cost recovery is a really major issue here that we wanted to explain a little bit further. And we think that it's important to recognize that, yes, those impacts to some of those, the impact of DG and all those other load modifiers are included in the transmission planning process and forecasting. So it may be fair to say that or recognize that those impacts could be more appropriately reflected in the current tax structure. But the issue we're running into is that it's problematic when we try to say we want to adjust the structure, which then impacts all those embedded costs and the allocation of those costs. So that's something that we wanted to make pretty clear today about why we think that the cost shifting concerns are justified or are valid concerns that folks had raised, and then have that discussion with folks about that a little bit more if people wanted to get into that. Again, we think that one of the main reasons that is a valid concern is because this may no longer reflect the historic cost drivers if we move the point of measurement and then start reducing certain entities. Pardon me. Jody, is this? My screen just died on me, folks. Sorry. Okay, it's back. Technical difficulty, sorry. All right, this is such a quiet group. Does anybody have any questions or comments on anything yet at this point? Go ahead.
Bert Hansen, Southern California Edison. I have a definitional question.
Sure.
When the ISO uses the term DG, distributed generation, does that mean in front of the meter only, or would it also include some behind the meter generation?
Well, I think
retail meter.
In general, when we say DG, we're including all in front of the meter and behind the meter.
And behind.
Yeah, but I think if we want to make it very clear what we're talking about here, we need to talk about in front of the meter wholesale DG and behind the meter DG separately. I think we should clarify that when we're having discussions about what we're really talking about. So that's a good question. But I think that right now, as I think folks from Clean Coalition have explained, the behind the meter DG is being reflected by the current point of measurement. So most of the focus that we're talking about here about the potential cost shift is related to the wholesale DG impacts, so that in front of the meter DG impacts. Does that help?
Okay. Thanks. Yes.
Yep. Go ahead.
Doug Kerpa, Clean Coalition. I'm going to try to not say things that have been said a million times before today. But to follow up on, I think, on some of these issues, One of them, I wanted to ask kind of two questions. One is this notion of DG incorporated in the transmission planning process. Point I think that you're familiar with. As the transmission has been built, the load that is served by DG over the last 20 years, which is to say all of it, right? There's basically no existing DG that's older than CAISO. CAISO is older than any DG. Since that was subtracted out in the transmission planning process, that would imply that the existing transmission system, those costs, were all designed to meet non-DG met load. They're all designed to meet transmission connected load because the load met by DG was subtracted out before that planning process happened. So that's one element that then would say that because that load met by DG is now getting charged for the transmission that was expressly not built for it, there's a cost shift onto those customers. And I realize there's disagreements about that, and we can talk about that, but that's an important point. And the other thing actually that came out very recently, and I'm going to steal Sam's thunder here, gets this concept of fairness, which I think is fundamental. You know, you're absolutely correct that that's a fundamental judgment call that we have to make here in cost allocation. And there's two different groups with any resource, like taxis, airplanes, whatever. There's the group for whom it was initially built, like it was envisioned it will serve this group. But if the use of a resource changes, like if the original, like say I buy a house, the original family that house was built for, they're not using it anymore, right? That now there's a new user who is now taking advantage of it. So then the question is, do we charge the people for whom it was initially built, or do we charge the people who are now using it? And I think one, this is Sam's insight, is have a two-tier approach. If a resource is being used by a new group of users and there is uptake of that resource and it's fully taken up and fully used, then it makes sense to have those users pay for it, the ones who are using it at any given time, and then have the original intended group, to the extent that those are different, act as a backstop so that if a resource is not being used to its full capacity, then it's like, okay, we built it for you guys, nobody else is paying for it, so now you guys are on the hook. I don't know operationally how we do that, but that is one of those, in this conversation, I've had a lot of people share strong insights with me that's like, oh, there's actually, might make sense to have senior, kind of the first set of people who should pay for it, which are the users, and if they fail, then the people for whom it was originally built. It's a slightly different concept. So I just throw out those two notions.
Well, thanks for that. I appreciate the comment, Doug. It's helpful. I don't know if I have a good response right now at this point. I think about that a little bit more. But you know, on your first point, I think it is about a fairness issue. I think you guys do have a point about the fact that since the planning processes took into account those resources and the size of the system may not be needed, or some additional sizing in the system or investment in the system may not have been needed because of the fact that we had the DG or EE reflected in there. That may be, I'll admit, I think that it may be fair to say that there is a fairness issue there, and I think it's also important to relate to how we're talking about that cost shifting issue and try to understand if that is the case where you have the DG reduction or investment in the system, the reduction of the potential investment in the system, quantifiable in a way that we can somehow track that and reflect that, that may be possible to consider, but I don't know if changing the point of measurement is necessarily the only way that we need to explore to do that. So that's important. And then I think on your second point about the users and who's using it now and who it was designed for, you know, I think that's an important consideration too. It's a fair point. I think that kind of goes to what we had spoken about before about the existing system and the future investments, and maybe if we were to, you know, kind of take like a bifurcated look at, okay, here's the existing embedded system costs and maybe treat those in one way. It may be fair to say that the future costs should be treated in a different way. Your concept, I think, maybe goes another step beyond that. I guess it does seem to me to be a bit difficult to try to understand how that could work in concept, but in actual operation, like you had said. But in concept, I kind of understand where you're coming from on that piece. So I'll have to think about that a bit more and see if there's any other reactions. So let's go back here in the back and then back up here, Yusuf.
And this is Stephen Kelly with IEP. I just want to respond to that, the picture that was painted there, because I think I fundamentally disagree with that. I don't think the transmission and even the distribution system is the house. It's the road that gets you to the house. It's the freeway that gets you to the road that gets you to the house. And if I add two kids, if I own a house and I add two kids, or two kids go away to college, it doesn't affect anything about the roads or the maintenance of the road that I'm going to be using and continuing to use to go in and out of my house. So I just fundamentally disagree with the paradigm that you kind of premised up there, and I think we need to think about it more as the trend. The T&D system is more similar to the highway system or the road system that everybody pays for than an isolated entity that it can be parsed off based on usage.
I think that exactly iterates my point, which is so if we're going to say it's a road system, look at how it's paid for. It's paid by gas taxes or usage fees by people who are using it today. We don't look at Highway 80 and say it was built in, I don't even know when it was built, say 1950. We're going to follow everybody who was a California resident in 1950 and we're going to charge you for it. You moved to Michigan. Fine. You're still paying for our California highways because you were the one that we initially built it for when we planned it, which is kind of how we're proposing is what's quote-unquote fair in this process, that if you're the initial set, when the thing was planned, you are locked in perpetuity. And it doesn't matter if other people come to the state or other people leave the state, you're the one it was planned for, you're the one paying for it. I'm not sure that makes a lot of sense, and it's certainly not how we pay for roads. Roads are paid for by people who are using it today. The Golden Gate Bridge, that toll isn't sitting at everybody's driveway saying all users have to pay for the Golden Gate Bridge. No, the people who drive on the Golden Gate Bridge, they're the ones who pay the tolls, and that's exactly what we're trying to get to as a Clean Coalition, is a situation where the users of the resource pay for it at the time that they're using it. When they stop using it and other people use it, then other people pay for it as it's used. Yeah, that's exactly, I think that's a great point, and it reinforces what we were trying to drive home.
Just to respond, I'm not sure it reinforces your primary point, but because if I go to Michigan, if DG wants to go to Michigan, for example, or the load that's going to use DG moves to Michigan, well, they'll deal with Michigan's costs. They won't be paying in California. But fundamentally, everybody who's driving a vehicle in one form or the other, well, it's not just the gas tax, by the way, but there's other means to pay for the infrastructure that is designed to enable people to move from point A to point B throughout the state.
Right. And so if I move to Michigan, I don't come to Michigan and say, I'm a new resident. I wasn't here when you built these roads. I don't have to pay for any of it because I wasn't part of the population you planned for. That doesn't get me off the hook. You know, if I come to the state and I start using it, Michigan charges me for it. If I come to California, I get charged at the time I start using it. So
let me just add a couple of points here.
Analogies will only get you so far.
I appreciate the back and forth. I think it's important because I think there's some validity on both sides here. First I want to just address the Golden Gate Bridge thing because I think you guys are kind of doing yourselves a disservice by making that analogy because it's not really the same as the Golden Gate Bridge toll when you back out of your driveway. I know you guys have made this before, so I just want to say my view on it personally. It seems like we should be talking about the highway system in general, and, you know, folks should be paying for the highway system in general. If you want to make that analogy, you know, and I know you guys have made like a taxi cab analogy where, hey, you should pay when you use the taxi, not like just because there's, you know, a fleet of taxis available. But I think maybe a more apt analogy would say, hey, look, there's a taxi cab sitting in your driveway that no one else is using that you can use any time if you want to. And also, I think, you know, the highway system analogy, it's not about the Golden Gate Bridge toll when you back out of your driveway and only use local roads. Everybody that uses local roads and never goes on the highway still benefits from the highway system. So there's some differences there, and I think that we just run into problems when we try to make these analogies all the time because transmission rate making is not as simple as these analogies. So I just want to throw that out there. I know that analogies help people understand things, but it somewhat kind of confuses people a lot too. So let's be really careful about these analogies. And I think the reality is that there's some validity to wanting to try to better reflect the true users currently and what the cost causation was. And I think that we want to try to do both because, you know, these are embedded costs. And so the assets that were put in place, yes, they may not be being used by the exact same set of customers, but the LSEs or the PTOs that made those investments may need to recover those costs in a way that fairly reflects the cost causation of them too. So let's keep those kind of concepts in mind too while we're talking about this stuff. And it is complicated. So that's kind of just my feedback on that discussion. And let's go back over here to John.
Thanks, Chris. And Doug, John Goodner with the ISO. I wanted to respond to the first part of your response about how DG's embedded and planned for, and that there should then therefore be some benefit to those that install the DG, because again, your assumption is that was reflected in the plan in the first instance. My point is that as a planning function, it's reasonable to assume that some distributed generation, energy efficiency, demand response, that those things will happen. And so it's reasonable from a planning perspective to take those into consideration in your long-term forecasting and what kind of investments and build-outs you're going to make to the system. But that doesn't mean that specific DG on a system de facto is a beneficiary of that assumption and that it should somehow be compensated because it exists. And my point is that just because you're DG and you happen to develop DG in this planning horizon where we made these investment decisions and you decided to build DG, so, oh, you must have been one of those people we were talking about. I don't see that linkage because that DG may actually be operated in a way that's not really beneficial or wasn't really set up for the benefit and coincident with the needs of the transmission system. It was set up for the needs of that customer or industry or whatever it was. And so I struggle with this idea that somehow all DG should just, because it exists, should benefit. What I'm more comfortable with is more of the expressed planning of DG that is, in fact, beneficial through things like the locational net benefits where it's specific projects or projects are identified that directly address, have the attributes to address the needs and defer and avoid investment in transmission, and therefore they should benefit. But this idea that just somehow because you exist and there was DG in the planning that, oh, all DG is created equal and should benefit, I don't make that linkage, and I don't see that the planning function is making that linkage either. These are reasonable assumptions in planning, but they don't necessarily translate to specific projects.
And just before you guys respond, I'll give you a chance after this, but this is Chris, and I just wanted to add, I think the way that you measure the usage of the system also does have an impact on and reflects that. If you can, you know, if you're using a volumetric method, then that can, I think, can drive some of these problems as well, or the perception that there may not be a fair allocation of some of those costs for the existing beneficiaries. So that's important to note as well. But please go ahead and respond, you guys. Thanks.
Thank you. It's all Mike, Clean Coalition. Just in response to that, Chris, you actually said part of what I was going to say is that's exactly why we're looking at the structure of TAC and billing. Obviously, if you change to something like demand charges, then you would only see the contribution the DG makes in terms of demand. If you're doing the volumetric, you'd see the contribution the DG makes to demand, to the volume. So whatever it is you're measuring, you do want to measure how it contributes to that factor. I also want to just clarify that we have never proposed doing something that is a subsidy or a benefit for DG or something else like that. DG does not pay tax. DG would not receive a reduction in tax charges. This the tax is charged to those entities who are load-serving entities or their customers. And the question is, based upon how much of those or in what way those customers are proportionally using the transmission system compared to other customers, how to properly allocate that. But the main thing I wanted to say is we identified several years ago some differences between load-serving entities, particularly those who are PTOs and non-PTOs, in how the transmission costs are allocated and how costs are recovered. And I think we identified some concerns, which I believe ISO has acknowledged are legitimate concerns with the role of local resources in relative to how TAC has been traditionally allocated, it being set up before those local resources ever existed. Because we identified a problem, we thought it incumbent upon us to also suggest a solution. We're not wedded to any particular solution, but we are intent on seeing that that the concerns raised are addressed. If there's a better way of addressing them or refinement, or if it turns out those concerns are not legitimate, then that's appropriate. But we're here to try to improve the system. We're not wedded to a particular solution to doing so.
Thanks for that. I appreciate that clarification because, I think that there has been some sense that one of the objectives you guys may have had was that it was just truly trying to create some kind of an incentive for additional DG production, or at least not necessarily a subsidy, but an incentive for LSEs to go and procure additional DG, maybe not reflect a more appropriate cost allocation. And so I think that, even for me right now, I appreciate you saying that. So I just wanted to note, thank you for that. I'll let you respond to that if you want to have one last thing and then go over to Barbara.
Thank you. I was just going to say we identified an imbalance in the procurement and market valuation approach, and we're seeking to address that such that we end up with the right combination based on what's most cost effective, and including what drives future investment costs. It's simply how to achieve those ends.
Thank you. Barbara?
I just wanted to say a couple of things. One is I find myself, as I do occasionally, agreeing with John Gooden on the point that he just made. We're not always in lockstep, but I think it's an important distinction. The other thing, two things I wanted to say. One is I think we should try to keep the discussion as calm as possible and not make it argumentative, because then people get worked up and it doesn't really get in touch with the fundamental issues. I don't like your analogy and that kind of thing, and I agree with you, analogies in this case are pretty tricky. But the other thing I wanted to say is with respect to the treatment of DG and the planning process, is there a distinction, because I'm not as close to the planning process as other people may be, between behind the meter and ISOM DG? For example, I know there are forecasts of the amount of PV in the planning process that's basically behind the meter and affects the measurement of the load at the meter. But I'm not familiar with whether those forecasts include in front of the meter DG and how that is treated, and that's just a question. I don't have an answer.
Yeah, that's a good question. So I'm not going to claim that I know the nuances of that transmission planning process that well. I would look to the audience if anybody else has additional experience right now. I think possibly Neil Miller should probably help me on this one, and I don't want to speak out of turn here, but he's not in the room at the moment. So Sam looks like he wants to respond, so go ahead.
Thank you. In the demand forecasts produced by the CEC and used by CAISO in the modeling, there it's simply looking at load as realized. So it does not distinguish specifically on that. Likewise, in the CPUC's integrated systems planning scenarios, it does not distinguish the different types of DER and DG.
Load modifier.
Right. Yeah, load modifier.
I think that's kind of the term that they generally use, is like a load modifier. EE, DG, behind the meter, you know, in front of the meter, DG, I think.
I'd also just take the opportunity to clarify regarding behind the meter assets. Those are reflected differently in TAC billing and TAC allocation than in front of the meter, but they're not absent from it. The energy which never crosses the customer meter and serves behind the load and so reduces the meter, that is not subject to TAC charges. But behind the meter energy, such as from a net energy metering process, which is exported onto the local grid and then is netted out against energy which does cross the meter, that would be subject under the tariff to the gross load at customer meter. So we estimate roughly that for a typical, especially residential PV installation, about 50% of the energy produced from that is reflected in the TAC billing determinant, and half of it isn't because it never crosses the meter.
Thanks for that clarification, Sam. I do have to acknowledge, I think that there is, we need to really understand exactly how those things are reflected, the NEM exports are being reflected. We try to clarify how it should be treated in the part of the proposal. apologize about my voice today, folks. I think we do need to make sure that, the ISO does recognize that those costs and impacts and benefits that are caused by DG should potentially be reflected in the future cost recovery or the future transmission access charge structure. But again, I discussed this with Clean Coalition a bit when we had a chance to talk, and I was, trying to express that it seems to be that there's a problem in if we were to move the point of measurement to try to reflect that now, then we impact all these embedded costs of the system, and it's hard for us to tell if that's an appropriate cost shift or not, or to at least justify it. So that's one of the things that I think we need to try to work through a bit more for our next iteration, and maybe explore that concept a bit more. Is there a way that we can look at that and try to quantify it? And then if so, is it then maybe appropriate to have perhaps a different treatment for existing versus future investments? And that's something that I think we do need to talk about more and seek feedback from stakeholders on for sure. So, but with that, I'm going to keep moving forward unless there's any other comments right now. Is there anybody on the phone, Jody? Okay. Where are we at? Okay. So this is the last part I wanted to talk about with the efficiency and the impact to the ISO dispatch. Now, I think there's some additional work that needs to be done here as well, so I'll point that out right up front. But one of the things we wanted to note is that these things are interrelated, the point of measurement and then the actual use of measurement usage approach. They are interrelated, and that can have impacts on the efficiency of our dispatch. This is something that our Department of Market Monitoring noted in their comments, and I think that that's important to try to walk through again here. So if you change the point of measurement, again, that may reflect better reflect the impact that DG has on future avoided costs that are already reflected in the transmission plan like we were just discussing. But if we retain our volumetric tax structure and then move to that point of measurement, then all of a sudden all of the behind the measure generation, I'm going to use that term behind the measure instead of behind the meter, because now it still would be technically behind the meter, but let's talk about the measurement point. So that's why, and I think DMM was smart to include that term in that way behind the measure. Then the load that's served by any of that won't have to pay for any of the volumetric tax charges, so then all of a sudden that resource appears to be less expensive than the transmission-connected resource. Now, there may be some justification based on the way that we did the forecasting and then the potential for a fair cost allocation to want to say, okay, that is appropriate to make that change and that they should be treated differently. But I think that it's important to note that if we do this, then there's these negative outcome because, or potential negative outcome, because then all of a sudden it looks like the load wants to have more DG resources that may be actually more expensive or less efficient all of a sudden dispatched because they have a lower volumetric charge that's going to be for their overall tax allocation that's going to be realized by them. So that ends up, it could cause the fact that we might not have the overall lease cost dispatch and impacting efficiency. I will note that, again, like I said earlier, I think we do need to do some additional work on this because we had talked with our market surveillance committee folks about this, and Ben Hobbs, our a really sharp PhD leader of our MSC, did a pretty good job of explaining kind of this concept in detail and put out a little bit of a simplified model that kind of explains that. And I think, you know, after some additional discussion with folks, I think it is fair that maybe we do need to explore that and maybe try to quantify that a bit more about how this would truly impact and maybe where there's a threshold issue where you can get past the potential negative impact if there's enough DG resources there. And I think you have to also take into account how you would treat the losses on the system as well. It's an important thing. And actually, I will give credit to PG&E and Hannah and Bill Peters pointing that out to us as well about the loss factor issue needing to possibly be considered in that kind of a analysis. So, but it looks like Sam wants to respond, so go ahead.
Thanks. Just one clarification. I think this is quite accurate regarding dispatch resources, but I would point out that that most distributed generation resources are not dispatched. They generate as they do. If it's stored in as a storage facility, that may be dispatched.
I see.
But while the dispatch in theory works, in practice, it has limited applicability.
Yeah, and I think that we do need to do some quantification of, you know, what are those wholesale resources that are that do have, you know, interconnection with the ISO system or you know, agreement to participate with the ISO system, and what does that look like in comparison to just some of these other, you know, non-market resources that are just producing, you know, as they will, or, you know, self-scheduling or however you want to put it, but essentially just producing at any time that they're able to. I think that would certainly be part of that kind of analysis to figure that out. We would need to know that. So that has been a bit of a difficulty for me personally, trying to run that kind of data down when we're working on a model that it kind of can explain these kind of things. With Brattle Group, we have been doing that, and so, you know, we tried to get a bit of that information. And internally, we don't really have a specific list of what resources are actually on the distribution system available to the ISO, so we need to either make some assumptions about it or try to get some additional input from PTOs and other, you know, UDC entities about those volumes. And so I think that's something to discuss a little bit further, and, you know, I think we should seek input about how we can get some of that accurate information. But, okay, so let me go over to Callie real quick, because I want to give some other folks a chance, but then I'll come back to you, Doug.
This is Callie Wells with Rosera Consulting. Just a very simple question. Did Ben Hobbs make that model that he developed available online? Is it under the MSC meeting materials?
Yes, it should be. I believe that there's, well, I don't know necessarily if he actually put like a spreadsheet up, but he has a memo that describes the way that he did it. I forget if he actually put the memo or the spreadsheet up on the MSC website, but it was during the December MSC meeting, and I can try to work with him to actually get the actual spreadsheet if it's not up there right now. So I can follow up on that.
Okay, that'd be great. Thanks.
Robert Jenkins, Flint RCI. Just on this last half of this slide and this whole concept about behind-the-meter generation and the volumetric tax charges, I think we need to make sure we consider there's another layer between in retail rate making, and just because you change the way the tax structure is done, the customer doesn't see that. The customer sees the retail rate making that happens. And so you may or may not be incenting the customer to do anything different by the way you change the tax charge. It's really going to be what they see, which is the retail rate making and how those wires costs are recovered through rates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thanks for that comment. You know, and I would just want to note that we heard those kind of comments previously and in the feedback we received in written comments, and that was one of the things that we pointed out in our proposal this time, where we're saying, you know, we need to take into account those different layers of rate making. And, you know, it's very complicated. There's actually really like three different layers that are happening here with the PTO, the high voltage level, the UDCs, and the low voltage for all the PTOs, and then underneath that, then the retail rates. And each of those has a different kind of muting effect depending on what you're talking about as far as incentives or behaviors you might want to create, which is why kind of going back to the beginning of the meeting where we said, hey, look, we're really not trying to do anything about changing through this tax structure modification because of that issue right there. But I will kind of, you know, turn it back over to Doug here to respond to that. But I do think that, you know, they've been trying to point out that, hey, they're not really worried about that incentive or causing some kind of a signal, but they just want to have more fair treatment for the way that the procurement and the forecasting treats that. So is that kind of a fair description?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Doug.
Thank you for that. I actually do think that, and also the I think it was John's comments about the treatment of specific distributed generators. It's important to remember that really we're talking about the level we're talking about is among LSEs. So in a certain sense, one of the things that initially attracted us to the change in where it's measured is precisely that it is invisible to ratepayers. Most, you know, for the most part. And so it's not so much about, and you know, mindful of your effort to not get into incentivizing anything, but just cost allocation. But it's not so much about looking at incentivizing customers, it's about incentivizing LSEs. And the idea is that each LSE, well, not LSEs get billed, which they don't, but UDCs get billed, and it's the UDC behavior and how that operates. And so what I think in this slide, when you're talking about load, it's important to realize it's like, oh, that's the procuring entity when that's going to be doing any responding. The second point that I wanted to get at is the very last phrase about distributed generation resources may not be the least cost dispatch. That phrase includes a kind of a critical question about what does the word least cost entail, because if you include delivery costs in that, I think one of the things, the idea is the intuition that if you include delivery costs, that DG is in fact is the least cost with generation and delivery, which then begs the question of how much of TAC is paying for delivery service as opposed to all the other services. I know had a discussion with Jan and some others that those are two separate components. There's sort of the fixed services that everybody gets no matter how much you use the system, and then there's some variable piece that is related to your energy delivery. And certainly in Ben Hobbs' model, the very different economic efficiencies depending on whether you're talking about fixed cost component of the TRR or the variable cost component, though those behave really, really differently. One of his conclusions was for the fixed costs, you leave the customer meter is really very efficient. And for the variable costs, or what might be thought of as the ones that can be affected by DG, which is by no means all of them, is that that starts to make more sense to have that component, which again, not every time I talk, I feel like I'm making this more bifurcated and complicated, which again is another thing we don't want to do. But just
no, I think that's fair. You know, I think that's kind of why I was trying to at least touch on that concept of that there may be some need to try to bifurcate this, as you noted, as far as you know, it may make sense to try to do the point of measurement in a different manner for some reasons to reflect what you're talking about. But when we ultimately came down on it, we said, well, it's hard to track what these cost shifts would really be impacting as far as like reflecting the cost causation that was initially in place. And so that's one of the reasons why we said, well, at this point, we don't want to try to make that change, but I think we can explore the potential for maybe having that idea of existing embedded costs versus maybe future costs treated a bit differently for the future proposal. But then you get into, well, okay, what about the costs and benefits of actually implementing this thing, and then is it really worth it to do that at this point? Also, I want to note that the LSC versus UDC issue is important. As you noted, we're trying to explain that a bit in the proposal. I don't think I quite got it fully explained as well as maybe I should have, but we need to have an additional rate-making mechanism, and I'll talk about that a little bit more here if I get through some of these slides, but this discussion is good, so let's continue it. But I think that it's important to recognize that we have to have that additional rate-making mechanism where we can true up the procurement decisions of the LSCs within an UDC area, so that way, if we were to make this change for even just for the future ones, future investments, that we're not just saying, okay, we're going to move the cost among the UDC areas without actually reflecting what the benefits and impact of the LSC decisions actually were, because then that could run into a fairness issue there as well. And so at this point, we're thinking, okay, it doesn't make sense to move the point of measurement if we don't have an additional mechanism in place. I think we can try to work to help describe that mechanism that would be necessary a bit further. And I actually will give some credit to you guys at the Clean Coalition for trying to describe that previously and multiple times. So thank you guys for that work. And I think that some of those descriptions are valid, and maybe we should explore that a bit more in the future. So that's my piece on that to respond to you. But Barbara's had her hand up for a while, so go ahead, Barbara.
I just want to clarify something. I heard a discussion about different costs. And what you have here is a joint cost problem. You have a grid that provides what I would call, and I believe I called in writing, peak versus grid services. Okay, so it's not that you can break up those costs. You have to develop an allocator to reflect the fact that you have a joint cost problem and that the same facilities are basically providing different services. So when you talk about delivery costs, I mean, it's basically using the same system to deliver as it is to provide ancillary services, et cetera. It's not that the costs are different. It's that it's providing multiple services, and you have to come up with an allocator, which will not be perfect, in order to assign those costs in the way that you think is most appropriate. But it's not a matter of deconstructing the transmission system or deconstructing the distribution system and saying these facilities are for this purpose and these are for another purpose, except insofar, for example, as you're talking about radial versus looped or something like that. So I think we really have to be careful when we use words to not imply that there are yet more things going on here than exist.
Yeah, and I think when we get into the hybrid approach that we talk about later on, you know, I struggled with trying to figure out a way to make the split between the potential cost that we would recover versus volumetric versus a peak demand charge because of that issue that you're talking about. And when we tried to make a explanation of a way that we could kind of make a proxy for an allocator, as you mentioned. To try to explain what would be maybe be perhaps considered a energy delivery function and what would be a peak capacity delivery function. And again, it's not an art, it's not a science, it's an art, right? And so that's the rub, I think, is it's very difficult to even figure out those two functions. And then also it's difficult to figure out the other benefits that we noted, and I think Klika and others really noted, and like ORA and other folks noted all those other benefits that I mentioned earlier about, you know, the reliability services that are being delivered that, you know, Doug was speaking to, where those are happening and being delivered all the time, and then there's another function with the energy delivery. So it's, you know, point well taken there, Barbara, on that. But, you know, it is easy to confuse these things, and the way that I was thinking about it, maybe we could explore in the future, was if we took all the existing costs and said we're going to treat them one way and then maybe the future costs differently. But then that also gets complicated because you talk about what about maintenance and refurbishment of those existing facilities and how would we treat those things. So there's a whole host of things that you could consider if you wanted to start getting into some really complicated rate design issues. And I think the notion of having like an allocator to try to figure out what percentage of each of those assets or function or pieces of the system, I'll just say pieces of the system, actually reflect those different services or benefits that are being provided. And so that's really why I shied away from trying to, you know, explain that we would develop something like that in this iteration. But if folks have, you know, some novel ideas about how we might try to go about that for splitting up either, you know, in some of those ways that I described, existing and future costs, you know, new projects versus already approved, and then maybe the maintenance and O&M related to those things. And then also I just want to note there's also some of these projects that are related to the reliability and other like things like what was some of the stuff that folks said. I think Jan put in fire hardening in your comments and other things like that, where there's other additional costs that aren't necessarily like traditional O&M costs, but they're necessary to help improve the system, and it's hard to put those into buckets of existing or new costs and how those things can be allocated. So that part gets really difficult when you get into the details of if you could make this thing really complicated, it may reflect the costs and benefits, but then is it going to get into something where it's not really truly reflecting the reality, is it? Because you can start to make it too complicated. So that's kind of my thoughts on some of that stuff. But I see a couple questions back over here. Sorry, Jan, behind you first, and then Jan.
David Oliver now again. To that point also, it's worth also keeping in the back of one's mind, or maybe a little bit more towards the front, how this allocation process would play out at the FERC in transmission revenue requirement hearings. Right now, as they currently are, where all you have to do is come up with a sum of money, basically, and a low in that load, and that's all you have to really do. It can be very difficult and contentious as it is. If you start adding in there trying to allocate cost to this bucket and that bucket, it can be even harder. So I just think in the back of the mind, you know, trying to fine-tune this to a point where maybe it gets to be too much at the, you know, at the actual implementation level also has to be a consideration, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I appreciate that. I think that we're definitely trying to keep that in mind for sure, and was one of the major considerations and justifications for this iteration of our proposal. So, but thank you for that. Jan, do you have any?
Ms. Jan of San Diego. I guess I just wanted to sort of say where we sort of, in the end, because we've had a lot of discussions with the Clean Coalition, and where we've just kind of come down to, we think the Clean Coalition proposal does have some theoretical merit. You know, as we've said many times, you know, trying to establish how much a particular UDC actually uses transmission facilities, it's really very difficult to do. We don't really have the right, you know, the measurement tools at our disposal to really figure that out. So what we came out was, when you look at the merits of changing the point of measurement versus the demonstrated benefits of doing it, and also considering what happens at the extreme when you take that to the extreme, we just found that there just isn't enough demonstrated benefits to justify a change. We're not saying there isn't a benefit, but frankly, we just couldn't get to the view that there's enough benefits to justify changing the point of measurement. That's where we are right now.
Thanks, Jan. Go ahead.
Yeah, I wanted to start off by saying I completely agree with Barbara.
Sorry, this is Doug again.
This is Doug, Clean Coalition. The notion of that allocator and developing that would be hugely helpful. But I think to leverage off the point of, at the end of the day, and this point you raised, this does have to get defended at FERC, does make me, it highlights that there is both a theoretical level to this of developing, like, what would the tools look like? How could we do this conceptually? It may almost be like an academic paper or a white paper to say, like, in a perfect world, this is how we would do it. These are the constructs. These are the tools. And I'm sure that those would all be very, very useful for people, rate makers all around the country. And then the second stage is then turning that into an actual tariff that's simple enough, captures most of the behavior of our theoretical discussions to be useful, practical, all that sort of thing. So I'm very, I guess, I would say grateful of those who have reminded me that, like, yeah, there are all these great theoretical benefits, but there's also, you know, at some point we have to make that analysis of, like, these are the things that are in, those are the things that we are great details, but they're not really in. So.
Well, and Chris, I just want to respond that there is no perfection to this, okay? I do this for a living. But the answer is that we do develop allocators in retail cases all the time for things with joint costs, like generation and distribution. So the issue is it, although imperfect, is it better? Can you make it better without making it perfect? And I think that's what we're talking about here. And, you know, I think the proposal that the CAISO's come up with about saying maybe doing some on a volumetric basis and some on a demand basis to reflect the different uses of the grid is something that I personally have encouraged. I think it can be done. Will it be perfect? No. But you're absolutely right. We should not make it too complicated. So that's true of all of us. The issue is, can we make a change that will be an improvement in terms of cost causation without making it so crazy complicated that there's no point in doing it? But we do this on a regular basis on the retail side, and we deal with these complexities on a regular basis. So just for what it's worth.
Yeah, and I just wanted to say, you know, I appreciate you guys acknowledging that, you know, that, yeah, there are a lot of things you could talk about theoretically and academically that it would be interesting to explore, and then you do have to try to bring this into the reality of the rate making and the FERC proceedings and making sure that things are, you know, just and reasonable, pass the test of just and reasonableness. And I think that the point that the Navigant gentleman made is very important here, because I know that those kind of allocators in rate cases can become, you know, quite the fight with different parties that have vested interest. And it kind of then it starts to come down to not really principles anymore, but how do you save money for your customer, or, you know, your entity or whoever your organization is. And that's also one of the reasons why I haven't put out that cost shift impact model that we have yet, because we want to talk about these things at a principle level before we start saying, well, how would these changes potentially impact people. So, but I appreciate you guys acknowledging that. So thank you. Let's go over back to here to Bert.
Bert Hansen, Southern California Edison. As I read the ISO straw proposal, I understood the division of the peak portion as compared to the energy portion would be determined at the ISO level, not reaching down into the revenue requirement determination of the individual PTOs. Is that true?
Yeah, that was our initial proposal. And again, I will get through. I want to get through some of this point of measurement stuff, and then we can really get into the rest of the hybrid approach design that we want to talk about. But to answer your question now, before we move on, yeah, I think that was the initial intent, was that we're trying to talk about it since the high voltage TRR does end up, you know, being socialized and it's a postage rate, not a license plate rate. The intent was to try to split up the overall cost and then allocate, you know, a portion volumetrically and a portion via peak demand vehicle. So that was the initial intent, and, you know, we do need to do a significant amount of work to develop that part of that split, and we'll talk about more about that a little bit later. But if you guys have opinions about, you know, if you think we should be doing it on a PTO level or UDC level, then, you know, I'd be interested to hear that and an explanation of your views on that.
Okay, thanks. I guess my view would be it would be much better to do it at the ISO level. It's extremely difficult to start dividing up PTO revenue requirements into different pieces.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that, but I just wanted to see what you guys thought before I gave you my opinion. But that's why we didn't, you know, propose to try to get down to that level in this paper. But again, open to doing some more a development of that for the future proposal. So let's keep moving forward. I think that was the last slide I have on this. Oh no, wait, is it? Yes, okay, so this is the part about the incentive that I want to talk about to try to drive this point home about why we don't think it's reasonable to do the idea of trying to create some kind of incentive for additional DG procurement. So this was something that was kind of described well by some of the stakeholder comments. And, you know, we did ask the question, should we be trying to incentivize additional DG through the tax structure? And, you know, we got a lot of point, and I will acknowledge again, Clean Coalition has said that's not what they're trying to get done. That's something that the ISO asked if we should do or not, so I want to make that clear. And, you know, we got a lot of feedback about it, and it was clear that everybody kind of agreed, or at least a majority of folks agreed that you could change the point of measurement, you could change the structure to try to incentivize things, but the ultimate resulting signal wouldn't really be useful for any type of a procurement decision maker because everything will ultimately result, the result will ultimately depend on other decisions made by other UDC areas and all the LSEs within those UDC areas. So it gets, again, back to that idea that there's multiple layers here and then the fact that the outcome would depend on other folks is important to recognize. And so I believe it was NCPA that included that this in a pretty simple explanation of this, but I just want to walk through it again so hypothetically with folks. So if you think about if we were to move the point of measurement, then anyone that had additional DG on their system would pay a reduced portion of the TRR because if you kept the volumetric. Again, I want to make sure that we're talking about keeping the volumetric methodology here for this hypothetical example. So if we were to do them moving the point of measurement to the TD interface but keep the volumetric method or approach for the billing determinant, then you would ultimately have folks that had additional DG resources in their UDC area paying a smaller share of the overall TRR. But that overall bucket doesn't go down, so somebody has to end up picking up those costs. Well, what would happen is all the other UDC areas would have to have an increased amount of TRR that they're covering. And then the problem that with this whole idea ends up being that if everyone were to additionally procure in each of those UDC areas a proportional amount of additional DG, then the ultimate share of the TRR that was recovered from each of those areas wouldn't even change. So it becomes highly uncertain about what the actual outcome would be if we were to do this as far as trying to make an incentive to procure additional DG. And folks mentioned that, you know, that's not really a primary driver and that the current, you know, incentives for the things through like the procurement processes should be what really drives those decisions. So I wanted to point that out. That's one of the things that we're kind of leaning on for our justification of why we don't think that the tax structure should be used for, you know, incentivizing or providing investment signals for different types of resource procurement. So the other thing is that the TAC is billed through the UDC, not the LSE. Now, we've talked about that a few times here. But again, this is where I want to talk about it again specifically. We would have to create some kind of an accounting mechanism to try to true it up within each of those UDC areas because even if we were to make this change at the TD interface for the UDC areas, then you would have, there's potential for multiple LSEs within each of these UDC areas. Obviously, some of them don't have that. Some of them, like the muni areas, cities that are PTOs, UDCs, only have one LSE there. But in the IOU territories, of course, there's many LSEs. There's CCAs, there's the ESPs, you know, direct access. So those folks would each have their own procurement of some amount of DG that would then need to be tracked. And again, this goes back to the Clean Coalition has tried to describe this in their comments. I thought they did a pretty good job of it. But the point that we're trying to get across here is we don't think it's appropriate to make this change without having that kind of mechanism already in place or accompanying this at the same time. And that's really not in the purview of the ISO. I think we could try to develop a way of accounting that and tracking those things. But, you know, to go back to the complexity issue, again, when we were trying to develop the cost shift model, we were running into problems trying to even identify how many DG resources are in each of these systems. So it becomes quite complicated, and to think that we would actually be able to do an appropriate accounting of that, it gets to be a bit mind-boggling. So That's kind of what I wanted to deliver on this slide. Sam wants to chime in. Go ahead.
Thanks. You addressed two things, two quick responses. The first, I appreciate what you said. I tend to agree with most of it.
Could you speak a little bit closer to your mic?
Yeah, thanks. Apologies. I appreciate what you're saying. I tend to agree with most of it. But just to clarify, no question, there are two components to this. And there's a question of like sort of chicken and egg, which goes first. We would be very understanding. We think it makes sense for the ISO to not implement a change until the other half of it is also ready. But for the ISO to propose a change which they would implement conditional upon the other half being there makes sense. And so, yes, both halves have to be there. You have to both have the price signal from the ISO, and you need that passing through to a place where it actually impacts the procurement decisions. Without both, it's not going to have the impact. The other thing I was going to say is, with your first point, you're talking about sort of on the TR and how that's divided. There's how you divide the pie, and there's how large the pie is. And there's a distinction between what the current TRR is and how the TRR is expected to grow over time. Absolutely, if all parties take the same actions and reflect the same proportion of what they're doing, to reduce their transmission measured load, that's not going to change how the pie is divided at all. But the impetus behind this proposal is largely one of looking forward. And this comes back into the question of new resources versus old. But looking forward, if each of those UDCs or LLCs followed a path to reduce their share of the TRR, the impact along the way is to reduce the growth in TRR over time. So they may not be changing their share, but it's a smaller pie in the future than it would be otherwise.
So yeah, I think that's one part where you guys lose me personally, and I still have struggled with, I guess, one point just being the modeling that you guys did previously, having some of the assumptions about the future growth of TRR. I take issue with some of those assumptions, and I know that you guys are using publicly available data, and you don't have a crystal ball to see what's going to happen in the future, and you're using the best stuff that you can. But I think one of the things was like that 5% nominal growth rate in the TAC. I will just say I think that is possibly overinflating that potential cost savings, just because we've seen varying levels of TAC additions either in the past 5-10 years, and there was a large build out of policy projects prior to the redesign of the TPP, but most recently we've seen a flattening out of the additions. And again, yes, I will acknowledge there are some additional costs that are, going to happen because of OEM, refurbishment, those kind of things for the existing system that will add additional costs too. But I think that it's really hard to predict the future, if there is electrification of the transportation and industry. I think that will possibly cause an additional large amount of transmission need, and it maybe if that isn't realized for a certain amount of time doesn't actually pan out, maybe there won't be so much of that. So that part of it, for most of the folks here, and I'm channeling some of Neil's thoughts on this, I think it's hard to tell what's going to happen. So to actually predict how much of an impact that will have is hard to do, obviously. And then just the concept of how the mechanism actually shrinks or slows the growth into the future, I still am struggling with that. So I'll let you respond and see if you can maybe clarify that for me a little bit if you want.
Thank you. In the modeling we presented, again, we used the best data we had available. We tried to use conservative assumptions, but that was meant to be illustrative, not predictive. And we invited ISO to update those numbers with anything you prefer, whether it's a 3% growth, a 5% growth, a 7% growth. If there's any growth, then there is an opportunity to try to mitigate that that growth, which leads to your second question of whether DG or other DER resources can mitigate those that growth. And we've established in previous meetings that that DER are, and including DG, is capable of mitigating each of those growth causation factors. Whether or not it does obviously depends on how it's deployed, what performance characteristics it has. And so if you have 1 megawatt of generic DG or DER, that's unlikely to have a one-for-one ratio in terms of mitigation. But it's going to have some level of mitigation. And depending on what the profile is, especially the aggregate profile of the type of DER and DG which is deployed, and where it's deployed, that will determine the proportion of mitigation of future transmission need that it would otherwise have. And we included in our model, based on PG&E's forecast and their experience in the DER, a D rating factor for the DG, how it affected peak load, as well as doing it just on a volumetric basis. And that's why we think it's appropriate to look at whether we should simply use a volumetric basis or use a demand charge. We modeled the volumetric because that's the way it currently is. We've also looked at the demand charge and see how it would contribute to that. I think it's clear that it technically has the capability. It has historically mitigated the amount of growth which is in there. The exact degree that it mitigates growth depends on those factors, but we can look at the existing portfolio of DG across the state and see what use that going forward, and if we think it's going to be a different structure or a different performance characteristic of future DG, or if the needs which it's addressing are changing over time with different peaks and things, then we should adjust the D rating factor of those resources to see how they would or what degree they would mitigate future transition growth.
Okay, thanks for that. Now, I guess to try to just follow up on that and maybe explore it a little bit more from my perspective, so can you try to relate to me how you see the fact that we're taking into account those future cost avoidance in the transmission planning process, and it should just, I think, be reflected in the procurement decisions and the transmission planning process and forecasting process and going through the future, and how that relates to kind of the concept that you were just talking about? Is that clear to you?
I think so. Let me try a response and we'll see if it adjusts it. We've talked about how some different drivers of transmission growth have been there, and one of which is policy. We saw in response to California's initial RPS requirements, 25% and 33%, a policy-driven investment in growth in TR. And we then saw that flattening out as those were built out and levelized. We've seen since then a 50% RPS and with a very likely likelihood of a higher RPS than that going out. In addition, we haven't yet seen that reflected in the TRR. Likewise, you also mentioned the move toward electrification of transportation and building energy use, which can be another driver of a future investment. Now, when we're looking at both meeting a policy demand for renewable resources, where those renewable resources are located has a big impact on what new transmission facilities are required to access those. If we're looking at load growth or peak demand, if that load growth can be met with resources which either use existing transmissions or which are located closer to the load and mitigate the impact of that load growth on the CAISO system, then that will reduce the need for new transmission. Now that comes in the planning process. To the degree that you are forecasting based on procurement practices and trends, where that growth is going to be, you are likely to see differences in the grid needs assessment. If you are predicting that there will be customer load growth, but that load growth will be served by local facilities, you are not going to, in the TPP, see a project need for new transmission. And so there won't be a project identified to mitigate in that case, because the need has been mitigated already by the local growth. So the TPP process looks at what you're expecting the transmission level. It's impacted with what you're seeing at the customer level, but you're really looking at the CAISO level need for transmission. In order to do that, you are incorporating the impact of DG in those resources even before you get to the point of a project alternative.
Actually, thank you. I appreciate that explanation. That enlightens my knowledge on that a little bit. I think that there's some validity to that. That statement, I got to think about it a little bit more, but I appreciate the explanation. Now, I want to go back to Steve back here. Do you have a comment, or is your mic still on? So,
yeah, I do have a comment.
Okay.
Stephen Kelly with IEP. I just want to follow up, I guess, on that point and some other points have been made. I mean, fundamentally, we've got two different kinds of investments here. One is what I'll call a long-term transmission investment, and decisions have to be made at some point in time. And the other are relatively short-term investments in DG resources that can be made in a narrower time frame. To deal with that reality of those two types of investment decisions that get made, we have a long-term planning process that integrates in it the best forecast that we can develop on where supply is going to occur and where load is going to occur and when. And after that is completed, then we determine what new transmission is necessary to meet the needs of the grid. And at that point in time, that decision to go forward with that long-term investment in transmission is an embedded cost. And anybody who leaves the system or avoids those costs in the future that were embedded in that plan, to me, you're fostering either cost shifting at best, or you're fostering a free rider syndrome at worst. Because all the planning for that long-term investment was made with full consideration of the future development of the DG resources and everything else. But once that decision is made, the investment is embedded. People are spending billions of dollars potentially. To your point, it may be that the planning process will come to a conclusion that no new transmission should be built because of the expectation of DG. That would be fine. That's the way the system works today. We're talking about moving down a very complex path to deal with allocation, and to Barbara's point, it gets very complicated. You can do it. But the fundamental planning process in California is designed to take this into effect at a relatively large level anyway. So I just don't understand the merit of moving forward with some of this stuff.
I can respond.
Yeah, please go ahead and respond. I think this is a interesting discussion, and I'd like everyone to hear your response. So.
Thank you. Yes, the one of the key components there is that forecast of where the new generation is going to exist, and that goes into the planning process. But a driving factor in where the new generation exists is in the procurement process. And to the degree that the procurement process considers the impact of transmission costs, and that's part of what we're looking at here, that will influence where the new generation is prioritized. What is actually the least cost area? Part of what drove this was working in the least cost best fit process, the CPUC, noting the lack of transmission of delivery costs for transmission in that procurement planning process, in that bid evaluation process. And because it's not reflected there, because all delivery is treated as an equal cost regardless of location, what that tends to do is drive under that policy locations which don't reflect the need for additional transmission investment in the future, and that drives more transmission investment and drives you away from a solution which is actually the least cost when you consider not just the cost of the energy, but also the cost of the transmission system combined.
Yeah, but just to follow up, those procurement decisions made by LSEs follow the decision to do new transmission, or all the other decisions to make larger investments that occurred previous to that. So they're already aware of those costs. If they make a procurement decision that they want to do more or less DG at that point, it's on them. But the decision is already made to do the transmission, so they can decide at that point whether additional DG makes sense in light of the costs that they're already incurring.
But if you're building the transmission based on your projection of where the new generation is going to exist, then you have a basis for estimating where you think that's going to be located and what transmission you need. That's entirely appropriate. We agree with that. But if your estimate is based on behavior, which is driven by an incentive to locate it in areas that are going to require additional transmission investment, then what you do is say, well, we think you're going to build it there. We're going to build the transmission. Now we've built the transmission, you might as well use it. It might not be the least cost option, but now we've already built the transmission, so go ahead and use it.
But that regret occurs almost with any kind of long-term investment. So if the answer is we're going to foreclose any long-term investment, we're not going to do transmission because we don't know where DG is going to occur, that might be mismatched, that seems nonsensical to me.
We're not suggesting that at all. We're suggesting that in doing that transmission planning, in looking at those future growth scenarios, we're looking for an adjustment in the forecast of where that growth in generation is going to be. And that growth in generation is influenced by the cost factors driving it. So if you change the cost factors driving it, you're going to change your growth scenario. You should use that updated growth scenario in the transmission planning process. I think that process is already set up to do that. It's just a question of getting the right inputs into it. And those inputs are going to be influenced by how the DAC is allocated, assuming it passes through to the procuring agencies.
But the issue of the inputs and the assumptions about when and where DG is going to develop in the planning process need not and probably shouldn't affect how you recover the cost of the transmission system that's already embedded.
Let me jump in here. So I think I appreciate this discussion. It's helpful, I think. I would say I can kind of understand where you're coming from, Sam, and I think to try to maybe put a different point on, a finer point on it, I guess, it seems like what you're trying to get across is that if we change the point of measurement to say we're going to try to allocate the cost in a way that reflects more the current usage of benefits of the system, then the outcome of that will be more procurement plan will happen of the DG resource that should feed into these long-term decisions, and then ultimately that will roll into this planning process in a way that's more appropriate than a reactionary way. Is that what you're trying to get across? I think that was what you're saying.
Yes.
So now I think the ISO recognizes that kind of a dynamic, and I think the issue that we're running into is it's that chicken and egg problem again, where we're talking about, okay, if we wanted to try to maybe potentially move the point of measurement, then we say, okay, that's going to affect all these embedded costs that we have right now and how those are procured. I'm not going to say that we're totally opposed to doing anything at all, but I think that that's a very important consideration. If we were to do something, then for perhaps maybe the future costs or some of the other things we talked about, embedded costs versus potential new costs and things like that, it may not reflect exactly what you guys want, but it may address some of that aspect, I think. But again, one of the issues is how can we ensure that there isn't inappropriate cost shifts or somehow track the cost shifts and make sure that they're justified if we were to do something like that? And then is the complications that would be required actually truly worthwhile, again, getting back to the points we had talked about earlier? Go ahead, Doug.
Yeah, thanks. I've developed 3 points. On the first one, the notion of billing going through the UDCs and the LSEs, I just wanted to put a call out for good thinking and input into our thinking on how to address this. Clearly, I mean, this was identified by Chris and Lorenzo very early on in the process, and I've gone to work and having some conversations about how, you know, the overcollection and refund method, and Jan, I think you were right, the way we did it initially wasn't right. So we have some tweaking to do. There is more tweaking to go on that process, which is largely going to, I think, play out at the CPUC, FERC, maybe at the legislature, but I want to have that conversation with the people, stakeholders in this room about what that piece of it should look like. So don't, if you thoughts about that, what that should look like, don't hesitate to reach out because I'm collecting those ideas. The second piece of it, we keep coming back to this question of embedded costs and the cost shifts there. And of course, one of the things that we keep trying to describe, I think unsuccessfully, is the notion that the current system actually has a cost shift in it that we're trying to correct. And of course, I'm struggling to explain it, but I think we came up with the one example. Let's kind of hypothetically think of an example, simplify California to two LSEs going into a transmission planning process in 1995. And in this, they both have a total of, I think we, you know, say 2 gigawatt hours of end-use meter load. So they're identical in terms of how much customer load they're serving. One of them has 100, or is anticipated to have in the modeling process, 100, is going to meet 100 of that with DG over the next 10 years in that TPP process. So that when it is time to plan the transmission grid, what's going to be built, what's not, planners look at it and they say, well, we've got to meet 200 from LSE2 and 100 from LSE1. So they plan that out, right? And then build that transmission to meet that projected load after the DG is incorporated. And of course, we know that that was built with planning to meet 1 gigawatt hour from the first LSE and 2 from the second LSE. But under the current system, even though one's contributing twice as much to that transmission planning process, the two LSEs actually get built equally. And so what that means is the LSE that came into the process with more DG is getting billed proportionally more for based on how much it was asking for in the TP process than the second one. And that's an illustration of what we're trying to get at. I see some shaking heads, so we can talk about that later or not. Because what I really wanted to get to is I think we're going around a little bit around some empirical questions. And this point, I think PG&E particularly has raised the point that there are certain factual questions we need to get answered before we can have sensible answers. You know, what would the benefit of this be? How much can load growth be mitigated by DG? Those are two really, really key questions. And so one of the suggestions that came out, and this is an SDG&E SDG&E stroke of brilliance, not mine. It might be useful to do a sensitivity analysis. And what that would look like would be to take the TPP model and change both the inputs, the projections of load growth and of DG growth, and see how much TRR changes. So you do a, say there's not going to be any load growth at all, right? That's one case. You have medium load growth, you have high load growth. And then on the other axis, you have there's no distributed generation growth that happens at all. It's totally flat. Nobody, no wholesale DG comes in, no more net metering exports, nothing. Then a medium level and a high level. And that gives you 9 scenarios of load growth versus DG growth. Calculate what the TRR under each of those 9 cases would be. We've, of course, got the one. I'm happy to see the guy from Navigant raising his hand because maybe he can do this. Then we'll have some idea of the bounds of variability of, one, how much of our TRR could in fact be mitigated by DG, and two, under different, we don't know which one's going to come out, but then at least we'll know, like, oh, if we're wrong and load growth's really high because EV adoption's really big, we have a sense of what that would look like, or EVs fall flat for whatever reason, we know what that looks like. And then, in a perfect world, we would design an allocator that responds correctly to each of the 9 scenarios automatically because of the way the formula is calculated. That would be lovely. That, like, in a way, whatever happens, our allocator will get it right. I don't know what that would look like. Barbara maybe does. But anyway, that's my input and vision. It might be useful.
Going back to the room? Yeah, back to the room.
David Haller over now. I just want to bring us back a little bit from the concept that DG can reduce the TRR is an interesting, whether or not, to what extent it reduces the TRR is an interesting question, of course. But the real question here is, does the measurement that we are talking about here, the changing of the TAC, reduce, or is it the kind of change that we need to make or want to make to bring about these DG changes? Because just reducing the TRR is fine, I guess, as its own thing, but I don't see how to make the leap from changing to the point of measurement to we're going to reduce TRR to something significant is the question. It's not the question of are we going to reduce TRR because DG is increased. The question is, I think from their point of view, the question should be, does this point of measurement, can they effectively prove that this change will reduce the TRR in the way that they specify?
Yeah, and I'll let these guys respond again, but I think that is the key question that is, you know, that needs to be discussed a bit more, and I think we need to seek feedback from all the stakeholders if people have thoughts about that. But I'll let you guys respond and then go over to Barbara.
Okay. Yeah, I think that if I understand that right, there's 2 questions. One is, will DG respond to a change in how much it's, how much, you know, will DG procurement change as a result of changing the TAC formula? And that is clearly clearly important empirical question. And I think to a real degree, the people who are in a position to answer that are actually wholesale DG developers, who we talk with rather, okay, some has some on that on this point before I get to question 2.
If I may, this actually all started back working, working with some of the municipal utilities, such as Palo Alto. And in their procurement decision, because they're a municipal utility, they do have their TAC charge measured in the way that we had suggested for all utilities, that's already in place. So for those utilities, when they procure distributed resources, which are not being delivered over the transmission system, they do not pay transmission access charges on those. So when Palo Alto was doing a procurement decision, they did an estimate of what the levelized 20-year cost of TAC would be. We're looking at 20-year contracts for new renewables. And they put that as a simple dollar figure into their bid comparison of looking at procurement from local resources on distributed resources versus power, which is available on the broader market through transmission system. And they evaluated the bids that they were getting with that cost factor. It was very simple and straightforward, but absolutely for that procuring agency that was, you know, that was under the TED-based transmission access charge measurement, which they currently have, it was a strong factor. At the time, this was 2012, their estimate of levelized, you know, TAC over the next 20 years was 2.4 cents per kilowatt hour, and so that is the adjustment they made in their bid comparison to choose which resources they would buy. So it definitely affects procurement. Now, whether the fact that they are not procuring resources that use the transmission system is going to mean that there's less transmission required, I think conceptually that's an obvious argument, but putting the precise numbers on exactly how that procurement translates into the future TER is another factor. But the question of, does changing the billing determinant impact the procurement decision from procuring agencies? Absolutely. I mean, that's where this all started from, is, we saw that black and white. And then we saw that at the CPUC, it was not being factored in that same way, and it wasn't being factored in because for those entities under the CPUC, it's not billed at the TED, it's billed at the customer interface, so there is no cost savings, there is no cost differential for a procuring agency who's within the CTO area to make that decision.
Yeah, and so to follow on that point, on this first question of how responsive DG deployment or procurement would be to change, we kind of have a natural experiment to at least, again, wrap our arms around empirically how big a boost would that be. And that would be to compare the munis to how much have they procured. And that's rather a lot, 100 megawatts in SMUD and Palo Alto and LADW. Well, actually, hold off on the LA story because I'm not as familiar with that. And how does that compare to how much procurement we've seen in the IOU territories? Now, of course, there's a whole lot of other stuff that goes in there, right? But, at first gloss, at least that'll give us some sense. And I think the other source of data that we look to is just talking with developers, and they're like, can we come within 2.4 cents of a central generation cost? Sure. The margins are close enough that we have a lot of, like, if you talk to Borrego Solar or NRG or, some of these other companies, they'll be like, yeah, that would make a big difference to us. So that's why we have some comfort with that, that the answer to that question is yes, it would respond. How much, though, is a critical question, and I'll have to think about good methodologies to getting there. And then, of course, the second question is the one I started with. As if, okay, say you see that, you goose it, now what happens to TRR? And you're absolutely right. We need to have a good answer on both of those.
Okay, so there's a couple more questions in the room. I'm going to make a quick response and go to Barbara and then to Bert. So I think that's quite interesting point you guys bring up, but I will note that I guess something that I think maybe kind of glossed over here as well is that there is a difference between the munis and the non-PTO areas and their treatment for some specific reasons, and I think that there's pretty good explanation by NCPA in their comments about that. And the fact that those areas have to pay for all of the impact to their distribution system based on their procurement decisions is different than a IOU area or another UDC area that actually has multiple LSEs making procurement decisions in those areas. Now, that really complicates this, and admittedly, I think you have a point that may be useful to look into this empirically, but the fact is I don't know if it's necessarily a fair comparison because of the fact that those decisions made at the UDC level for IOUs or areas where there's multiple LSEs will have different impacts on the UDC needs. Those costs, I think, maybe are a bit ignored in some of this calculus here, where
if you build out a bunch more DG resources, that's going to have a much more distribution cost associated with that. Now, how that actually gets allocated can be different based upon how many LSEs are in that area and those various decisions that have been made by each of those LSEs. So that's something that I think we need to keep in mind here, and I wanted to point out. Now I'll go over to Barbara here and then over to Bert.
Okay. One quick clarification on that.
Sure, go ahead.
Under the CPUC cost recovery rules for distributed generation, distributed generation, if it triggers an upgrade in the system, the generator pays that upgrade. There is no socialized reimbursement, and so any upgrades to distribution grid are included in the PPA price of that energy.
And I understand your guys' point on that, but I would just point out that I believe that there's also some additional cost that can be created when you start having significant levels of penetration of DG that may not be captured when you look at just one interconnection request and at that level, that I think it's important we need to try to recognize that that may add some additional costs that aren't controlled by how each of the LSEs is making procurement decisions. It may ultimately be a combination of many resource decisions that could drive some certain amount of cost there, and I think that may not be actually captured through that interconnection requirement that they increase their, or that they pay for any increased cost on the distribution level. Now, I would look to maybe perhaps the other IOUs here, other folks to try to help me describe that a little bit, but there's those, you know, distribution modernization costs that may not be actually, you know, attributable to one particular resource, but that they are going to be allocated to all those UEDC customers. So that, you know, I think that's something that we need to talk more about. Maybe I think I need to explore that a little bit more.
Based on cost benefit in the DRP, the resource planning process. So there's a cost benefit analysis done on that.
Mm-hmm. Anybody else want to respond to that? Barbara?
Okay, I did quite a bit of research on that a couple of months ago, and I don't have it with me. It's more complicated than you're making out because there are layers, but it is true that distribution and transmission are not treated identically. Having said that, it's more complicated than just saying one pays and the other doesn't pay. And I'm not prepared to speak to more detail on that because I'd have to check my notes so I would be accurate. With respect to the Muni decision-making process, I agree with Chris that being an MSS and making that calculation is different from not being an MSS and making that calculation, but it is also true that through the IRP process, I would think that when LSEs are making decisions about adding resources, that rather than talking about trying to make all these other adjustments, if they simply take into account the possibility of a future transmission cost when making a choice in some sort of methodical way, that solves the problem without having to go back and fix all the rest of this, as we've proposed in comments we've submitted in this particular stakeholder process. The other thing I wanted to say, and I don't think we need to get into it now, but Doug, when you were talking about billing going to UDCs and not LSEs and the whole over-collection and refund proposal that you said made work, it's a very Rube Goldberg process in my opinion, and it completely intertwines wholesale and retail. I don't think there's a legislative fix, frankly, because of that. I don't think a legislative fix is warranted because it would, by definition, probably be pretty kludgy. And that's the last thing we need is more kludgy stuff. So I personally have a particular concern about that proposal, and I just want to suggest that I don't have any problem with thinking about whether there's a better way to do it, but I really do believe that the simplest way to address this issue is to get potential transmission costs taken into account by LSEs when they make procurement decisions and not moving a lot of money around among various entities in a very complicated allocation mechanism. So just for what it's worth, I'm not going to chew up any more time, but that's bits of thoughts on various topics. Thank you.
Okay, thanks, Barbara. So I'm going to do a time check right now. We got about 5 minutes until we were going to break for lunch. Bert wanted to say something. There's another comment over here. A couple more comments over here, so I'm going to go to Bert next, and then Bill, and then to the woman behind Bill, sorry. And there's someone on the phone, too. Oh, yeah, they've been in the queue for a while. Okay, we'll go to Bert first, then the phone, and then over to you guys. Okay, go ahead, Bert. Thanks.
Okay, Bert Hansen, Southern California Edison. I'll make it quick. There are differences, of course, between munis, as they were called, and I would call non-PTO wheeling entities that have a retail service area.
That's the correct definition of them. Yes, thank you.
To be precise. But those are wheeling customers, and they realize the 100% of the transmission charge benefit if they build in front of the meter or behind their wholesale meter DG, and that does not necessarily translate at all into lower transition costs for the ISO as a whole, even though it is a benefit to them as an entity. So I don't know if we can conclude anything necessarily about a muni or a non-PTO wheeling entity behavior in terms of how that might translate into more or less DG on the system in terms of how that might work on a PTO service area. So it may be just an example of cost shifting within the ISO grid. That's all.
Thank you for that. Okay, let's go to the phone real quick and see who's on the phone. Operator, is there still someone with their hand up for a comment on the phone?
Yeah, I believe I'm unmuted. This is Tony Braun for the California Municipal Utilities Association. I appreciate Bert and Barbara's clarification and use of certain terminology. I would caution against using the term muni to cover a host of public power entities within the ISO's BAA. There are many flavors, more than one, more than two, more than three. There's been pointed to Palo Alto, who has a particular flavor as part of an MSS aggregation, which comes with a host of costly planning and operational responsibilities in order to qualify for that treatment. There are entities that are PTOs, as been referenced. There are entities that are neither. There are entities that are non-PTO UDCs. There are entities that are not that, too. So you're going to get into an entire quagmire of trying to figure out what these entities are and how the costs are being allocated, when in fact it probably has very little differentiation from the norm. Having some familiarity with the factors that get into public power procurement, it factors in a number of things in addition to costs, such as local job creation, portfolio diversity, and those kinds of factors. So, again, I don't know what that type of exercise would add to the discussion here. I would note that it certainly makes sense to take into account all costs and all these factors when examining future procurement. So that's certainly something that we favor. Most of that is not in our purview. It's handled somewhere else. But I certainly don't want to leave the impression that we don't think that transmission costs should affect LSC's procurement obligations, but that just doesn't seem to be the issue that we're dealing with today. But overall, I just didn't want to leave anyone with the impression that there's one flavor of public power entity within the ISO's BAA and that there's just a myriad of different treatments.
Thanks for that, Tony. And this is Chris, and I will apologize for the broad stroke muni verbiage there that I used. And Bert's description was actually accurate, and mine was being a bit too broad. So I will try to be more careful about that, and because you're quite correct that we need to make sure we're being specific when we're talking about those things. But I actually do appreciate the comment that maybe it might not be the best to try to compare those different entities, and I agree with that. I think that it is a bit complicated by the factors that have been discussed already, but so I won't recap those. So I'm going to go over here to Bill and then behind Bill.
Thanks. This is Bill Peter with PG&E. And since we're just talking a lot about LSC procurement, I thought to kind of weigh in here on like PG&E has an LSC in this. And I think, you know, I think it is important that we do consider the impacts of when we're procuring of like wholesale BG versus a transmission connected resource on the transmission grid. And I think we've tried to do that in several ways. You know, we have the LCBF methodology, the RPS calculator tries to weigh those things, even the CalISO's interconnection process. What I struggle with a little bit more is that, like, how much we're talking about, you know, how to guide LSC procurement here when this is really about, you know, changing the point of measurement for TAC. And I think that's kind of like a indirect backdoor way to try to really change that when there are direct procurement mechanisms that are looking at these type of issues. That's just kind of my personal feel of like how we've gotten a little bit off track here when we're really not talking about LSC procurement directly. Thanks.
Thanks for that. And behind you.
I'm Lisa Dowden, in this case representing the Northern California Power Agency, and I don't have my technical guys there, but I guess I just want to reiterate that procurement for the munis I represent covers a whole host of factors, including the state requirements for renewables and whether they're, you know, behind the meter or on the transmission system. There are a million other factors that go into what you're going to procure. And transmission costs can be a factor, but I wouldn't call it the largest one driving things. A lot of what's driving things is state policies, and it seems like a more appropriate way to address that those kinds of procurement issues is through the state policies and not necessarily through the CAISO transmission.
All right. Well, I think we've had some pretty good discussion here today on this issue, folks. So I appreciate everyone, you know, having some thoughtful input here. And there's certainly a lot more work I think we need to do to try to explore some of these different threads that we've talked about today. So, you know, I will definitely look forward to that. I'll try to put together some really thoughtful questions for our comment template to try to explore some of these concepts a bit more. And if anybody has ideas about, you know, kind of how to word some of these questions, I welcome those too, maybe offline if you want to talk to me about that, so we can try to get the best feedback possible. Now, I think that with that, I'll try to wrap this part up, and we're going to move on to lunch right now, and then we'll have the use measurement hybrid approach proposal discussion after lunch. So thanks to everyone, and we'll be back at 1 p.m. Thank you. All right, folks, we're going to go ahead and get started again, so grab your seats if you can. All right, so for the afternoon, that was a pretty good actual use of our time. I'm glad that we got through some good discussion on the point of measurement issue during the morning session, and so we, you know, allowed for some significant time to go over this hybrid approach for the usage measurement that we are proposing this afternoon. Hopefully we can get through it before 4 and everybody can go home early, but and then I can stop talking and hopefully not lose my voice, but bear with me again. Again, feel free to jump in at any time if you guys have comments, and I let me know if there's anyone on the phone as well. So. Let's get back into it. On the hybrid approach for the measurement of use proposal, the ISO has noted in our overview that we are proposing to use a hybrid approach. Currently, we do use a volumetric approach. You know, we're measuring how many megawatt hours are to be billed for the billing determinant for TAC purposes. Now, this originally was influenced by the perception of fair cost recovery and reflecting mainly the benefits of energy delivery function. Historically, when this was initially created, I believe that this current structure was put in place in 2001 and then reaffirmed in 2012 when we had to, the ISO had to do its Order 1000 compliance filing, which mainly, you know, is focused on the planning process, but also does include a review of the TAC structure. So that was something we mentioned in the paper in section one of the sections where we discussed kind of the fact that we believe that the current approach is still just and reasonable. but we do admit we think that this approach may not reflect the current use and benefits of the system as well as it possibly should or could, and particularly in respect with capacity, the delivery of capacity on peak and also for other some of those other essential reliability services that we had discussed in the proposal as well. So again, we're proposing to modify this current volumetric approach to a hybrid billing determinant, and we're recommending using, again, part volumetric still and then part peak demand measure to do this modification that we think will reflect the cost causation a little bit better and possibly the benefits that are being currently received by users as well a little bit better than perhaps we are currently under the volumetric approach. So, I think we heard a lot from stakeholders about the various functions of the transmission system that was discussed pretty thoroughly in many of the written comments we received. And, one of the major themes was, hey, there's more than just energy delivery here. We're talking about capacity delivery and also reliability benefits for peak conditions and also, you know, during other times of the year as well. So, we heard those kind of feedback, and we wanted to try to incorporate a new methodology that may capture those aspects a little bit better. And we think that this hybrid approach captures both the energy and capacity functions more accurately. And this is because the peak demand measurement is more useful for determining the use and benefits, obviously correlated with the system peak load periods. And those are a historic cost driver of the investment in the existing system, especially when you're talking about reliability projects that we've approved through our transition planning process. And obviously the existing system, even prior to the ISO, had obviously some of that function as well. we also think that since we were proposing a hybrid approach, that's appropriate because it wouldn't limit just the TAC recovery to simply the peak demand periods, and that's more applicable or appropriate here because we do recognize that there's still benefits that, flowing from things like policy projects and economic projects that have more of an energy delivery function occurring benefits throughout all hours of the year. So again, kind of drive that point home, we think it's more appropriate. One of the benefits of adding some peak demand measurement is to try to allow for the cost and benefit of serving customers with low load factors and high peak demand to be more accurately reflected in the cost recovery, because the volumetric methodology alone simply doesn't differentiate between when these users really use the grid, and it's not perhaps reflective as should be for some of these users that may have high peak demands but maybe, you know, low load factors. So that's one of the a benefit of the peak demand measurement. but one of the downfalls is that then if you use the peak demand measurement, you could possibly disregard some of the costs and benefits that are being provided during off-peak, which is why we're thinking it makes sense to try to do a hybrid method where you have some volumetric and some peak demand. All right, this might go really quick this afternoon. Any comments or questions yet? Okay. Anything on the phone? No? All right, so one of the questions that we need to answer here, if we're going to do this hybrid methodology or hybrid approach, we need to figure out how often we're going to make these peak demand measurements. That's a really important aspect of this, right? So, you know, obviously the volumetric is just a, you know, monthly measurement of all the volume that's going, the throughput. But for peak demand, you have to look at a particular period in time and take that capacity value, the peak demand value that is being reflected by each of the customers' use. So, you know, I've thrown out a couple ideas here for the frequency. In other regions, we see a variety. Generally, there's, you know, the annual peak, which, you know, and again, a lot of people refer to this as CP, like one coincident peak, 1 CP, 4 CP, 12 CP. So, again, you know, the annual peak is meaning 1 CP, seasonal peaks, you know, four seasons, 4 CP, and then monthly peaks, 12 CP for each month. Taking a look at that, and then even I believe that PJM also uses daily coincident peaks, so they do 365 days that they take these peak demand measurements. So there's, you know, a variety of ways that we could go through this and do that kind of an approach. but generally, we think that, you know, it's pretty well established precedent that the frequency should be intended to reflect the way that the system's really been planned as much as possible, and the intended benefits that are being provided intended through the planning process. And so the last bullet here explains that, you know, we think that the ISO TPP, since it plans the system to meet monthly peak, monthly system coincident peaks, we think the monthly measurement can kind of align the frequency we do this measurement with the planning process, the way that we plan the system. So that's just an initial idea for people to think about. We didn't specifically propose to use 12 CP or not, but I think that that was just something I wanted to throw out today, and we do mention kind of how it does align a bit better than some of the other methods might in our proposal. Jan, and then over to Bill.
Yeah, this is Jan from San Diego. So one thing here is just a point of clarification. Use the term coincident peaks, monthly coincident peaks, system coincident peaks. So you're saying each UDC would be evaluated with respect to its relative contribution to that single Cal ISO area-wide system peak?
Yeah, that would be the concept that we're trying to get across.
Okay.
Before you go on, I will mention, later on I'm going to talk about possibility of maybe adding in something like a non-coincident peak. And I know that San Diego Gas and Electric has explained how, you know, you guys use that in your, you know, UDC allocation to the customer classes. And so that's something that we didn't put in the proposals explicitly that we want to use, but we do want to explore the potential for that because there are some, you know, advantages and disadvantages to using either of those, but I'll let you continue. Go ahead.
Okay. And then the other thing I want to clarify here is what's the basis of actually measuring the peak? Because there's sort of two basic ways it's done now. One is, you know, they add up all the generation and all of the imports, and that equals the peak. So that's sort of doing it from sort of the, you know, working your way down from the top. But at the same time, the utilities report up all the actual end-use meter data, and that kind of builds up to a number. And so for the peak purposes, I'm just wondering which direction are you thinking to establish what those coincident multi-peaks would be? Would you be using it based on the submitted meter data, or would you be using it based on the sort of the top-down approach?
So initially, I think we're thinking that we'd want to relate that to the submitted meter data that we have
okay.
as well, you know, to mirror the same way we do it for the volumetric method. But, you know, I guess I'm not as well versed with that other methodology that could be used. So, you know, if you guys have ideas about how you might do that, if it makes sense to do so, you know.
Well, I don't think it does, and that's why
okay.
I wanted to make sure of that, because
okay.
I think implicit in that is a whole bunch of netting, that, which is one of our concerns, of course,
right.
with some of the proposals. So.
Okay. Thanks. Over here, I think Bill had a question now.
Yes, Bill Peter with PG&E. I just had a quick question related to, like, the frequency part. How often is the TAC basis basically updated right now? So when we talk about like an annual load, how frequently are we updating that annual? Is that question clear?
So the TAC rate is updated every month. Okay. And posted for each month, I believe. So I think that's what you're asking. Is that,
yeah,
is that
every
right?
month. So if we, these same frequency of peaks would be updated on a similar type.
That's
of
right. But I think that, you know, it's taking into account the IPER forecast to you to set those rates, I believe. So that is like done on an annual basis, and we just have that kind of static monthly load forecast for the year that's done through the IPER. That's how we kind of apply that to get that ultimate TAC rate that's designed each month, or posted each month.
Okay, thanks. That's helpful.
Okay. Over here.
Lisa Dowden for NCPA. I wanted to follow up on Jan's question about the top-down or bottom-up and netting. On page 18, you talk about a change or perhaps a clarification of how gross load data is reported in terms of net energy metering export. But you say that's going to be somewhere else, maybe not necessarily in this. And will that, I don't know how big a number we're talking about there, but wouldn't that have an effect on some of those numbers?
Yeah. So that will have an effect on that if you know, the NAM exports are netted from the gross load data that's submitted to the ISO, that would have an effect. I think the ISO is concerned that there may be differing treatment of the load settlement, gross load settlement data that's being submitted. I didn't specifically get into that in any of these slides because we are trying to work out what that potential impact to that might be at this point, and we're trying to do that kind of outside of this process. But we included that section in the proposal that you noted. And so actually I'm glad that you brought that up, you know, because we wanted to clarify the way that the ISO is interpreting it is that those NEM exports should net it off of the gross load settlement data. And I think that has some wide-ranging effects beyond just the TAC. Certainly has an effect on the TAC, and we need to try to get a handle on that. And that's why I included a note in the proposal where we are probably going to have to take a look at that issue perhaps outside of this forum. I don't want to prejudge anything that we're going to do there or any type of other clarification or anything yet. So I think this might be a little bit premature to describe kind of anything else beyond that right now. So hold on, Barbara. I think we have over here was next, and then back over here.
David Oliver, Navigant. I just want to clarify. The TAC rate is updated whenever there's a new ruling or filing at the FERC. It is not updated, and the loads are based on those FERC filings with the net load that is put into the TO cases for the IOUs or whatever. They're not the IPER numbers. So they get billed monthly, I suppose, but it's only updated whenever there's new information that comes
through. I see. Yeah, so thanks for that clarification. I think that's correct. So I was describing just when we post the updated rate that we're charging, but I think that the actual update to the inputs to the rate, like including the TRR updates, would happen, as you noted. So thank you for that clarification. Sorry if I kind of mischaracterized that earlier. And then I think Barbara was next.
I also had a question about data. My recollection is that the transmission revenue requirements and the rates are based, in the TO cases, the rates are based on the gross load figures that are in those filings. So if you're going to be doing this on a monthly basis, what is the source of the demand data for coincident demand for the different, I guess it would be UDC PTOs here and the other PTOs? Does the end use retail data for all customer classes for all of them include at least 15-minute demand data?
Well, okay, good questions. I might not be able to answer that last bit myself. I think I need to maybe do some more homework before I can give you an accurate answer.
I'm just thinking this is something we need to know.
Yes, yeah. Certainly. So I know that there's some different treatment amongst the IOUs as far as like what kind of actual data is used, and I think some use like load profiling to actually come up with the hourly load profiles, but I don't want to try to characterize what folks are doing right now because I'm not an expert in it. But the intent would be, again, to use that gross load settlement data that we have, you know, defined in the tariff that we currently use for the volumetric measurement as well. And I believe that that would allow us to take a look at what that hourly peak demand would be, coincident to the ISO system peak for each of the UDC areas. But as far as that second part of your question goes, I think that that's important. I think we need to try to maybe take a survey of what kind of treatment folks have and if that is applicable to this, you know, if it's fair to use that kind of data or if we need to try to develop something else. But I don't have a great response for you at this point.
Yeah, precisely. That's what I was not clear about is volumetric data. You obviously collect because you bill on the basis of it, but when it comes to demand data, and in particular if you're talking about things like coincident peak, that has to be metered fairly narrowly so that you determine what the coincident peak hour is and then what everybody contributes to that. And at least on the retail side, that's done on a 15-minute basis. So you would need to have access to data that would allow you to know what the loads were on a, let's just say, a 15-minute basis in order to figure out those contributions. And I don't know if you collect those data.
Okay, so just to respond to you, I was under the impression that I think we could have accomplished this if we had hourly data that we do today, but that is something that I think we need to look into, and certainly wasn't specific in the proposal. That issue itself, so something to develop further in the future. So thank you for raising that concern, and I think we definitely need to look into that. We'll have a better answer to you. So does anyone have other?
I can
sure.
Just add a little bit here, so I don't think it's going to be particularly helpful, except to say that the 15-minute data generally does not exist at the residential level. At least that's what I've been told, that it's pretty much limited to commercial industrial classes. So I think we're going to have to work around some inherent limitations, at least initially. Not saying we can't get there, but from what I understand, we're not there yet.
Yeah, I think that's right, at least for demand response purposes. I mean, they've actually had to reprogram the meters to do 15-minute to participate in the real-time market because it's basically 60-minute meter data. That's my understanding as well. And that's just for the IOUs, and I have no idea what anybody else does.
Yeah, I think you know it might vary depending on the particular entities. There might be certain UDCs that don't have the same kind of technology as others, or you know maybe not the capability at least or data ability there. So that's something to definitely look into, I think. Okay, is there any other comments or questions right now at this point? All right. So now getting into what Jan had alluded to a little bit and I kind of alluded to as well, this idea of coincident versus non-coincident. So, you know, we think that, well, first off, let's just state the first bullet, you know, coincidence and non-coincident peak demand charges, you know, are not mutually exclusive. We might be able to use a combination of these things. We might, you know, want to explore that because it might capture some of the usage and benefits provided to certain customers that have different peaks than the overall coincident peak, but may, you know, use, you know, a significant, or not use a significant amount, but derive significant benefits that might be off peak. But the issue there is maybe that doesn't drive additional costs, so that might not be appropriate. Now, I think for this purposes of our discussion, we're open to suggestions here. I think we need to do some more homework ourselves at the ISO, try to determine what the best outcome of this would be. Is it appropriate to try to do some combo? Should we stick to just the coincident peak demand charge? That's really how other ISO regions across the country generally do it. I don't know of any that have a non-coincident peak component to their rate making, but for the transmission cost recovery. But I think that, you know, since we have opened this up to try to look at the overall structure, I think it's important to at least note that that could be a possibility. So, Jan?
So, Jan, just a comment here. I don't think we've locked in on any particular approach here, but what I guess I would observe is that the allocation mechanism, the high voltage TRR, is going to go just to UDCs. It doesn't, as you pointed out in the paper, it doesn't go down to the retail level. So I don't know how that skews the thinking, but we're dealing with big numbers here for the most part. And so, you know, maybe a less, I'm just thinking that maybe a slightly less precise approach, like just using the coincident peak, might be acceptable. Again, we haven't made any decisions on our own, but just for thought purposes.
Yeah, thanks for that. That's kind of where I personally have landed on this, just in my initial thinking on it. So, you know, good to hear some other thoughts on that. Is there still someone on the phone? Operator, could you open the line that's on the phone?
Can you hear me? Hello?
Yeah, try to speak up a little bit, please.
Oh, I said, can you hear me now?
Yep, go ahead.
Okay, I was just wondering, what type of additional information do you plan to provide stakeholders in order to be able to provide some realistic input in terms of the ratio between the volumetric and the demand charge structure? So I'm reading through your slides here. There's a lot of factors, you know, that would affect this ratio. So I was just wondering, you know, when and where do you plan to provide any additional support or studies that we could look at in order to be able to provide you some realistic recommendations in terms of ratios between the hybrid and in the hybrid approach?
Okay, you're trailing off a little bit there, but I think I caught the gist of what you're asking. And could I ask who was asking that question?
Oh, yeah, this is Joseph Abuleme from the Office of Repair Advocates at the CPUC.
Thank you.
I'm just wondering the information that we could review in order for us to be able to provide you additional input in terms of the split.
Absolutely. So, you know, to respond to that, so we have put out an initial just rough explanation of how we might go about potentially splitting the TRR based on these different approaches for measurement. Again, it's just really rough and initial. I think we need to think about that more. So, you know, we certainly plan to develop that concept much more detailed in the additional proposals and the iterations in the future. But you know, initially, and I'm going to get to that in a little bit in a couple more slides here, so we can talk more about our initial ideas. And there's just some rough numbers that we have right now at this point, but hopefully we can provide some additional data in the future. But I think we want to hear maybe feedback from stakeholders about other ideas, concepts, and then what kind of data would be helpful for folks to look at. So hopefully that works for you guys. So any other comments on this coincidence or non-coincidence, then we can get into kind of how we're going to do the split. Sure, go ahead, Tom.
Just conceptually, it seems like it would be really helpful to get a basis of comparison for how it would play out, you know, comparing the two options and seeing if,
sure,
if they were actually significantly different in terms of cost allocation. The other factor, of course, is whether it's appropriate to use a non-coincident peak. It'd be worth considering, and this would be, you know, based on ISO feedback, the degree to which the cost causation is associated with non-coincident peak. You know, if the investments, if each major service territory has, know, distinct contributions to their investments that are driven by the peak of that service territory relative to the overall cost being driven by overall system-wide costs.
Yeah, thank you for that comment. So I'll talk a little bit more about that modeling that we're working with Brattle Group to do a little bit. I know that model currently doesn't have it built in to do a non-coincident versus a coincident, because we were really focused on the idea of coincidence when we started building that initially. But all the data that we have there in there could be easily used to adjust that model to do a non-coincident versus coincident. So I might have to work with them to try to develop that a little bit further, because I think that's a fair idea there to try to explore that and what the difference in the impact would be. On the other question, on your other point, I do agree with you. I think it would be valuable to take a look and see, okay, really where are the off-peak or on-peak cost drivers and what's the magnitude there. It gets to be pretty difficult to track that kind of thing. I wanted to do that for this proposal, but I just ran out of time and manpower to get something like that included in this one. I ended up having a very rough idea of how we could do this split that doesn't relate to the on-peak and off-peak nature as much as far as the trying to identify those cost drivers. But I think that we are open to trying to figure out a good way of doing that. So I appreciate the suggestion and welcome kind of stuff and your other written feedback, and I will try to get that kind of a analysis done. So before you go, Craig, was there someone else over here that had their hand up? No? Over here? No? Okay, go ahead. Sorry, Doug. I've mixed you guys up a lot. I'm sorry.
I'm thinking of changing my name to help that issue. Maybe to Chris. I don't know.
That would be good.
That would be good. So I think starting with the notion that, I mean, this is all driven by the notion that peak demand actually is driving planning of the, in the TPP process. And so I would think that it would make sense that to stick with the coincident peaks because that's what's used. And it would strike me that usage off those peaks really falls under the category of you're using the existing infrastructure that was built for something else, right? It's built for peak, and so that seems like that would be captured more in the volumetric component of this, because that is more of you're taking advantage of the existence benefit of this giant infrastructure that's not being fully used at the time off peak. And the other key, well, I guess you're going to get into this, is the division between how much of the costs are driven by peak versus other stuff, and I think you have some data on that as well.
Yeah, thanks. I appreciate that comment as well, because I tend to feel pretty similarly about that. I think that was kind of some of the thinking that I had initially as well. So that's a good comment, I think. So we'll definitely explore that a little bit more. Any other comments in the room right here? Bert?
Bert Hansen, Southern California Edison. Would the NCP be determined on an aggregated basis based on the submitted aggregation of all load, or would it be for each individual customer determine the NCP and then sum all those? So in other words, in which order are things done? Sum first or determine NCP of individual customers first?
So I need to look into the modeling that we're doing as far as the impact that we looked at, and I believe that the way that does it is taking a look at all of the data and then summing it all together. So I think the first one, the former that you had described, I believe is the way that we were thinking needs to be done, not individually finding what their coincident peak was and then trying to tack that together or something. Mm-hmm. So, but I'm not that well versed in how that would actually need to be done. I think we need to describe that real clearly in the future proposal. So. Please describe that kind of a question again in your written comments, and we'll try to make it clear for the future. You want any other comments at this point? Okay. Oh, Barbara, go ahead.
Okay, so would the expectation be that the calculation of coincident peak or non-coincident peak, would it be at the PTO level? Would it be at the UDC level, which could or might or might not be the same thing? What would you be measuring? And I mean.
So initially, I believe we would be trying to do it at the UDC level, the same way that we do with the volumetric charges. So okay. Mirroring the same entities and measurement, using the same data that we use for each of those UDCs, since we have that for the volumetric use. We want to try to reflect that as well, similarly for this peak demand.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions?
This is Stephen Kelly with IEP. I believe coincident and non-coincident peak data are submitted in the IEPR process at the CEC by LSEs, I guess. Would these data then be cross-checked at the aggregate level?
Well, for the purposes of the TAC billing, I don't believe so, because you know, it would, that forecast data would be used for the setting the ultimate rates, but then when you're actually doing the billing, you're only going to be relying on the actuals. I think there could be some kind of a, you know, a sanity check or something if you wanted to, you know, do a benchmarking against that data, but I don't know how you would, you know, justify doing some kind of an adjustment or something according to that forecast data, because obviously forecasts are going to be wrong, and, you know, they probably won't even be on the same day, let alone the same hour for that coincident peak for each month. So, you know, there might be some variation there, but, you know, interesting thought. I'll have to give it some more thought myself. Thanks. Anything else? Okay, let's keep going. Okay, so I think this is a big one that everybody wants to talk about, determining the TRR split under this hybrid approach. So the ISO has to determine what kind of a portion of the TRR would be collected through each of these components of the hybrid approach, the volumetric and the peak demand measurement. So how are we going to do that? That's obviously probably going to be the most controversial or hard to figure out issue here, and to get some consensus. It might be pretty simple, you never know, but I think that one will probably be pretty hard to actually get agreement on. But we did propose two options here. Again, I do want to just say these are initial ideas. These are not our final proposal. This is a straw proposal, and we have more iterations. So if people have issues with these, I can certainly understand that they need to be developed further. But again, the idea here is we're intending to try to split these costs so that we allocate costs associated with energy delivery functions more through the volumetric portion, and then allocate the costs associated with capacity or other reliability delivery functions through the peak demand portion of this hybrid approach. And again, it's going to be pretty difficult, we think, to determine the exact cost drivers of what should be a part of the existing system for the energy function versus capacity and reliability functions. And then, you know, I think that there's ability to do this in a lot of different ways. So, you know, the ISO here is open to suggestion, but here are the first couple ideas that we have for initially to get some initial reactions and kind of stimulate some thought. the first one would be to try to attempt to reflect the cost of the system that are associated with each of those functions based on looking at how much we've actually approved for transmission investment broken down by project category. Now, I think Barbara's comments were helpful in trying to kind of explain how, you know, reliability projects kind of have that capacity function, capacity delivery function, peak demand. It could kind of reflect that pretty well. And then again, for the policy and economic, that is more of an energy delivery function. And so what we've done here in this little breakdown that we've done for you guys is trying to explain the various cost categories for each of the project categories, and then what breakdown that would be. So you can see that here, and I did include just from 2010 till 2017, but also the policy projects prior to 2010, because there was a significant number, $7 billion that was spent. Now, I will note, and I put a nice footnote in the proposal to explain this, but those aren't technically policy projects under this new transmission planning process, because that was just initiated and put in place in 2010. But, you know, our planning folks here have told me that those projects that I'm putting in that category of that $7 billion could be related to the interconnection and other types of projects that were required to allow for the 33% RPS policy. So that's why I included those here. Now, again, this is just a rough breakdown of these projects that have been approved. And the idea is it could be a proxy for trying to explain how much of the functions are reflecting either the peak delivery, peak demand charge and capacity delivery function, and then the volumetric aspect and the energy delivery function. So that's the idea here. So if you took that rough estimate, you know, approximately 42% of those projects were reliability costs and reliability project costs. And so we would, you know, we could possibly allocate 42% of the overall TRR based on that split for the, and use the peak demand function for that, peak demand measurement for that. And then 58% of those costs that we included were related to the policy and economic projects, again, what we think kind of mirrors an energy delivery function benefit there. And so we would say that we could possibly split those, that portion off and use the volumetric approach for that. Now, if we were going to do something like this, again, it's trying to be a proxy for the idea that, you know, it might not be, we might not be able to accurately say what every single asset and investment actually truly, what function it is intended to serve. And again, I want to note, you know, many folks have pointed this out. All these investments are going to serve some function, some functions of each side of this, some delivery of energy, some delivery of capacity on peak, some, you know, on-peak functions, off-peak functions, and these other reliability benefits that we mentioned. So many times, you know, those things are hard to determine exactly how to do this. So this, again, this is a rough idea, but this is our initial thoughts of one way to do it. And then the last part I want to note here is that, you know, if we did this kind of a ratio split based on, like, approved projects, then we might want to have to figure out a way to update this ratio as the different amounts of approved project costs change in the future under this approach, rather than, like, keeping it static or something. So I think we seek feedback on that idea. And I got a couple comments in the room. Let's go back.
David Oliver now. Just a clarifying question on slide 25. Are these numbers a strictly high voltage investment, approved investments, or are they all investments?
Sorry. They are just the high voltage.
Okay.
Doug?
Yeah. So these numbers reflect the individual projects that are planned, but this doesn't include the operations and maintenance budget or the refurbishment budget or any of the general upkeep, which is...
That's correct.
And that would all be sort of assigned into the volumetric bucket?
No. So.
Okay.
So, yeah, so proportionally. So like, the idea here for this initial concept was to just apply that 42-58% breakdown to the entire TRR bucket, not just the existing approved projects, but it, overall, like all of the embedded costs that are now in there for O&M, for refurbishment, for all that, and then split it based on this split because we think just that it can be used as a proxy to say, hey, all these functions are going to have some amount of each thing, but we think that in general we need to have some way of splitting it. So does that make sense?
It does. It runs considerably counter to the point that a lot of stakeholders have raised, that those costs are fixed and aren't necessarily responsive to the cost drivers that you're trying to get at. And so if we're treating those as fixed costs that are incurred based on, you know, the existence of the existing embedded costs, I'm not sure why it would make sense to now then turn around and assign those to people who happen, you know, to rather to LSEs that happen to have a, you know, a high peak, you know, during the system-wide peak, which I imagine is going to be in Southern California with air conditioners, because those fixed costs are not responsive to these policy, to these drivers of new transmission investment. Those are kind of two fundamentally different mechanisms. So that's been my understanding of what everybody's been saying this whole time. So it seems like that really, those fixed embedded costs, again, need to be treated differently than the new project planning investments. And if they're going to be both deemed to be, if the fixed costs are proportional to the drivers of new transmission, that's not what we've been saying this whole time. That's a factual matter. So there's a bit of a mismatch, I think, here.
I don't think I'm quite following you, but I guess I would just say that my initial reaction to that is that, well, right now we're doing it all on volumetric, so we're still including all those fixed costs in that same type of allocation. So this would be doing a similar thing, but I guess trying to at least reflect some amount of the TRR in the peak demand component, just because I think we have recognized that the current volumetric approach doesn't doesn't reflect any of the peak cost at all. So does that make sense a little bit?
No. That part does make sense. I wasn't very clear. On this theory, so my understanding, the hybrid approach is designed to get kind of at two things. There is a component that is designed to recover costs for the kind of the existence value, the fixed benefits that everybody kind of gets from the grid being there. And then the demand charge piece is designed to get a handle on the elements that are driving transmission build.
That's not what we're intending, actually. Sorry, Doug. So do you want to jump in? Do you mind?
No.
You can finish your point if you want.
I'm just trying to help. I think we've got a couple of different things going on here. What he's doing here is an embedded cost allocation, okay? That is looking at the embedded costs on the basis and trying to find an allocator for those costs. What you're talking about is a marginal cost analysis in which you are looking at the drivers of future costs and trying to assign them. You don't mix the two of them. Okay? So...
But we just said this proposal does mix them.
Sorry, folks, just to jump in again here, I got to say this because we need to have everybody try to state their name and affiliation every time. I know that we're all familiar with each other here, but for the folks on the phone, please do that. Sorry. Thank you, guys. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Go ahead, Doug.
I may have to work to make this point clear. So these are at any one of these planning years, each of these projects represents a marginal cost in that year, right? Because they're a new build. So there's other existing embedded costs from everything that was built prior to 2010, right?
Well,
that's all sitting there and wasn't created, you know, the operations maintenance of the stuff that was built 20, 30, 40 years ago, that's just kind of ongoing. That cost isn't driven by any of these factors. We've got an existing infrastructure that can't be allowed to degrade, which means that what causes those costs is different than what's, you know, because these are marginal costs in this table.
So
not anymore, but at the time that they were incurred, they were. At the time the costs were driven, they were.
So Doug, the idea is that, you know, we're not trying to reflect the marginal costs here in this. What I'm trying to get across with this part of the proposal is what Barbara had said. This is just a simplified and rough way of making an allocator for how to split these embedded costs. So don't even imagine that any of these costs are at all a marginal cost. These are all going to be embedded costs. This is just simply saying, here's a rough estimate way of saying what each of these functions we think these are actually applied to. So the idea of having a peak demand charge component is not about reflecting the marginal cost of each of these new investments or anything, or future cost drivers. It's about reflecting what was an actual cost driver for the on-peak needs, for those reliability needs of the existing system better, because right now we're not really doing that with just the pure volumetric. I hope that makes it a little bit clearer, but I got a bunch of hands up, so I'll go over here to Bill and then over a couple of folks over here. So go ahead.
Well, just following up on that, I mean, I think it's trying to align it with cost causation, you know, to understand that, and thanks for kind of clearing that out. So a couple questions on this. You know, is there data available that you could provide on this kind of question of refurbishment and upgrades of existing facilities? Because then I think we could get a sense of, you know, how important is that here, and do we want to rethink how that, is that really a different type of, does that work with this type of allocation? Would be interesting to know. I don't know how available that data is for you, but if it is, sharing that might be helpful.
Mm-hmm. Like a ratio, like a percentage perhaps of, okay, how much of the TRR is based on initial capital investments, how much is on O&M and other refurbishment and other projects, fire hardening, other things like that.
Yeah, that might be helpful data to share. And then I also had a question just on like kind of the prior to 2010, very specific question on this table. You know, why is the reliability thing zero in the policy? Like, why did you include policy projects but not just to clarify that?
Well, just to be fully transparent here, because it was not easy to figure out what those costs actually are prior to 2010, and I actually didn't want to put in something that may be mischaracterizing what kind of costs those actually were. So for the economic and reliability project, I don't have a good handle on that. I think we need to do additional work to try to get that information if we were to do that. But I thought that it was appropriate to include this idea of the policy projects here, because that was such a significant amount of spend that we think, the policy especially does try to reflect that idea of the energy delivery, or that would be the intent here. So
thanks. Wasn't trying to be on the spot, but that's helpful.
Oh, no, absolutely understood. I actually fully expected that question when I had put those two dashes there on that one. Understood, and I think we do need to try to, refine this certainly in the future. So let's go to the gentleman right to your right, your left, sorry.
Robert Jenkins, Flint RCI. Before I ask my question, I'll caution. When we start getting numbers, we find ourselves running down a rabbit hole and chasing things that we, in the big picture, might not be that important, but that's more an argument for your other method of just saying, well, let's just split it. That being said, numbers being out there, there's several things that come to mind here when I look at this table. One, under the policy, maybe the generator reimbursement of the RNUs and the other network upgrade costs associated with generator interconnection that don't show up in the transmission plan. That can be rather substantial. That could impact the policy numbers, reliability numbers.
Just to jump in here, sorry. I think that those were a lot of the things that were driving that policy prior to 2010 number, because those weren't specific policy projects, but that is what we included there because they were intended to meet that RPS goal. Yeah. So but that's a good comment. Thank you.
Yeah, that would turn some of your dashes into actual numbers and some of the other columns. Also, I know, in the work that's not presented in CAISO and the transmission plan that's in the rate recovery, there's a reliability, at least in PG&E, there's a major work category for reliability and system automation that is not associated necessarily with refurbishment or just replacements or whatever, but it is improving the quality of service to customers. And that's similar to reliability upgrades, and that's about 18% of PG&E's capital expenditures. So it's not insignificant, and it could be parallel with the reliability. The third comment would be we go back and grab pre-2010 policy, but we don't go back and grab pre-2010 reliability. That seems to add some asymmetry to it. So those are all things. One's impact policy, some impact reliability, I think there's a way to fill out the table a bit more and get a bit more detail in there. But may just be better to go 50-50.
Well, I appreciate your comment. I think that kind of mirrors a bit what Bill had mentioned as well. I think, we do need to maybe fill this out a little bit more detail. And again, it is rough estimates initially. And again, I will say that I think those are good comments as far as, even going to kind of the idea that Bill had about looking at maybe what are those other refurbishment costs, but what are the RNU and other interconnection costs, what are those other reliability costs. I forget, what was the term you used again? Sorry. It was like a customer improvement.
In PG&E's, at least, they have their TO cases broke down into major work categories, and there's a reliability and system automation.
Okay.
It's not associated with necessarily refurbishment or replacement or maintenance. It's really just improving either the operability of the system or the reliability of service to customers. It could be a number of things in that category, but it sounds very similar to the reliability row you have in your table that may add to that.
Thank you. I think we definitely agree that we need to look into that and add some detail here on this stuff. So, Callie?
Hi, this is Callie Wells with Rosero Consulting. So I'm going to preface this with, I understand this is the first cut at figuring out these numbers. But curious, do these numbers include the projects that, while they were approved in the TPP process, have been recommended to be canceled?
No, those are taken out.
Those are. Okay. So as we, I think that's something that we need to keep in mind is we're, you know, if we continue down this path of exploring this as an option, kind of what projects make sense to include in these. So I'm looking at 2016, 2017, and the, you've got $24 million there. Have those costs actually been incurred, and does it make sense to include those numbers in this allocator if the costs associated with those projects aren't necessarily have been incurred yet and are reflected in the TRR?
Yeah, those are good points. Thanks. So I will try to double check for sure about the if there's any of the canceled projects or postponed projects that are in these numbers. I believe that they're not in here right now, but certainly need to make sure of that. And then that's definitely a fair point about, you know, these other projects that have been approved in the last few years probably aren't in service yet. So I didn't get into the in-depth amount of trying to look at the costs and see what ones are actually in service or not, but I think that's fair. Especially if we're going to start setting rates based on this, that's certainly a fair comment to make. So,
and that's exactly why I prefaced it with the answer. This is your first cut. Just
and I appreciate that too. Thank you, Kelly. So, was there somebody else over here before I go back over to Sam? Right, yeah. So, go ahead, Tony.
This is Tony Zimmer with NCPA, and I also appreciate the challenge this is. Just to make sure I understand. This is looking purely at the initial justification that was defined through the transition planning process and isn't necessarily looking at how the costs are categorized in the TO tariff filings. I just make sure I understood that distinction.
Yeah, that's right. So these costs are just solely for the ISO transmission planning investments that we have approved. It doesn't include any of those other breakdowns that were mentioned here as well about the TO, you know, costs or anything like that. I think that that's fair to try to look at some of those costs and try to maybe categorize some of those as well. I think that would maybe make these this allocator more accurate. But again, on the other hand, then you're going to get it maybe possibly into disputes about what do those costs really mean, what category should they be in. And so there's trade-offs here, certainly. And I didn't want to initially at least try to speak for any of the TOs or the IOUs about, you know, what their views are on these different functions and delivery of benefits of their system either and their other, you know, components of the TRR. So this is I certainly think we can try to explore that, and I hope that, you know, folks kind of try to explain some of these concepts and their feedback as well, because it would be helpful for us too. So thanks. You have a follow-up? Go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry. No, thank you for that additional feedback. I appreciate this. And again, I'm not asking the question because I'm opining as to whether we support or not, just more for us to think about. And in terms of the hybrid approaches, has there been any thought about how that would potentially be realigned with how the TO rate filings are made in a purely volumetric basis? Would there be some process to consider how those two aspects would be lined up, where the volumetric approach is used to ultimately define the bucket that's then tossed into this model? Or that's probably not a fair question, this question, but it's something that our members have been kind of asking about. So.
No, it's absolutely a fair question. I think that we need to try to at least describe how we would do that. Haven't done that in this initiative yet, or in this iteration of the proposal, but it's a valid question, and I think, you know, I will point out that, you know, it's not under the ISO's purview to try to adjust that, but I think that as a part of our potential modifications here that will have an intrinsic, you know, interrelated impact somehow, and you know, at least the least we can do for future proposals is to try to describe that and then possibly explain what the impacts would be if we have a recommendation about, you know, should the PTOs go to their FERC rate case and try to adjust that, and maybe, you know, if we have some thoughts from all the other stakeholders, that would help us maybe describe that a little bit better. If you have an idea and your members, you know, have a strong opinion on it, we'd love to hear it. So thanks. Barbara next, and then go back over to you.
Yeah, just briefly, I think the idea of getting the TO sense of the breakdown of their transmission investments and the drivers for that would be helpful, because it is certainly true that replacement is very different from building something new. It's just taking an existing facility that needs to be, I think the gentleman behind me said, refurbished so it can continue to operate and provide service. Another thing I wanted to say is I think at one point somebody conflated O&M and replacement, And so, I mean, replacement, the way I think of it is replacement investment as opposed to O&M. And O&M, you can have obviously fixed and variable O&M, but a lot of times the way O&M is allocated is using a proxy allocator. It can be labor, it can be dollars, it can be a lot of things. That those are basically things that are not easily directly assignable, and so you come up with a proxy for doing it, and then, you know, you sort of, it can be three-factor. I mean, there are a whole bunch of them, both for marginal and embedded cost analysis. So there are conventions for doing that, that if we go in that direction, could be, the information could be provided about them. And then I made my brief comment about an embedded cost analysis, and we are not doing a marginal cost analysis here. We are doing an embedded cost analysis, which means we're not allocating on the marginal cost of incremental investment to serve incremental load, but we are looking at a way, taking an existing body of revenue requirement and finding of the fairest way we can come up with to allocate it on the basis of cost drivers. And you just have to be careful not to mix the two because they're inherently different. And I'm not going to talk any more about it.
Well, thank you, Barbara. I will say and affirm that comment. That is the intent here, that embedded cost allocator idea. And thank you for the concepts there about, you know, how you might look at maybe the O&M costs. There might need to be allocators for those kind of things. And it gets to be complicated when you talk about what functions necessarily some of these investments are related to. And some of them can have multiple functions, obviously, and do have many overlapping functions. So that part could get very complicated. Hopefully we can keep it as simple and understandable as possible, because I would rather it be something easier and more straightforward than something as complex as perhaps the retail rates have been in certain jurisdictions. So, you know, but if it makes sense to do something, I think we're open to ideas for any of those concepts. So thanks. Going over here to Sam, please.
Thanks. Sam Mike, Clean Coalition. First, I just want to really appreciate, Chris, you actually making the effort to put this table together and take a first stab at this. It is very helpful. My comment is this does a great job of breaking out the different sort of initial cost drivers. We talked about additional refinements. For those things built under CAISO's purview, but the total TRR includes everything that was built prior to that time as well. And the $13.6 billion on here is only a portion or a fraction of that. On that basis, I'm not sure that, well, I like the idea of trying to break it out to see how it comes up. I'm not sure that just this time period, without reflecting the other, is an appropriate way of breaking out those fractions. And there, you need to consider what the cost drivers were for that prior investment as well in order for this this approach to be appropriate.
Okay, thanks for that opinion. And, you know, I do understand that. Certainly, I think that there should be some kind of recognition of trying to break down the other costs that were included before, embedded in the system before the ISO transmission planning process, you know, kind of took shape. But that, at least initially, was extremely difficult to try to figure out. I welcome other concepts as far as, you know, the ability to try to get some data that we could actually use to do that, and suggestions for that, and if anybody has those. But, you know, I certainly understand that comment, and I think that we do need to try to expand that. But so, again, another kind of just admitting this is the first rough step on this.
I completely agree. It's just, you know, if, for example, we found that prior to 2000, the investment for policy purposes was almost zero, mm-hmm. then the total fraction might be 20% instead of 55%.
Yeah, it could make a big difference. You're right. That's very correct. I definitely agree with that. And, you know, I don't think we had very much public policy going on, you know, previously, historically, that would be driving transmission costs. So, you know, that is more of a in the ISO's time frame kind of a concept. So, certainly understand that, and I definitely agree that, you know, it could have big swings here on this, but you know, I think for our purposes initially, just for this allocation idea or allocator idea, you know, we will try to improve this a little bit more. So thanks for that thought. Jan?
So this is Jan. So just for amusement purposes, I actually went back with actual capital expenditures that our company made from 2012. So unfortunately, that excludes like the Sunrise Power Plant, which is a whole chunk. But I went back and looked at our expenditures from 2012 through 2017, and based on my own informal and not to be repeated numbers, 24% were for reliability, and the remainder were for everything else, which would include, you know, interconnection of new generators, grid efficiency, public policy requirements, replacement or upgrades of existing facilities, relocation of facilities, customer employee safety, that's like the fire hardening type stuff, grid visibility and control, we talked about that one earlier, and there's another, let's see, then there's some other minor categories. But anyway, I guess the point being that, you know, 24% was reliability, 76% was not, but those numbers could change a lot if you include prior years where there's a lot of expenditures we had. Sure. So I don't know how much that helps, but...
No, it's helpful. Thank you. You know, and I think that it's fair to start to debate these things. We need to, I mean, because we're not married to any of these final concepts yet. You know, we need to develop this further. And, you know, as I was talking with some folks about this previously, and, you know, even for some of the interconnection project, just to try to, like, play a devil's advocate here, you know, some folks have included that, hey, there's actually deliverability kind of concept that's related to some of the interconnection of new resources, so maybe those should actually be included in kind of a reliability concept. Those are resource adequacy resources that have a capacity deliverability function that could be somewhat of a peak capacity delivery function as well. So, you know, again, this is not a science. It's going to be an art here. We're going to try to have to do something that's, you know, as accurate as possible, but I think that your point's well taken. So, you know, and I really do hope to hear from everyone about this more, you know, in depth, and if they have thoughts about breaking down the IOU cost, you know, those things are actually, you know, kind of more open in the rate cases and stuff and accessible, that kind of data, but hearing specifically what folks think each of those cost buckets actually relate to the possible cost drivers like the volumetric versus the peak demand, and then the, you know, energy delivery and capacity deliverability. I would hope that, you know, we can get some good feedback on that stuff. So we'll certainly be asking about that in the comment template. But thanks for that initial.
Yeah,
comment.
I would just say too that, you know, the numbers that I went through included all the low voltage stuff as well.
Oh yeah.
So in order to get a really useful, you have to go out and extract all of the low voltage and separate them out. So who knows what the numbers would come out if you did that.
Yeah, and let me tell you, it's certainly not easy to start to try to categorize these costs, as you can see how roughly I've done it here. You know, but I do think we can improve this, so we'll work through that for the next iteration. Any other comments at this point? Let's keep moving forward. Okay, we got through that one. Okay, so now here's the other more general and easy method where we don't try to actually allocate all these functions specifically based on some kind of a cost analysis, but we just say generally, look, there's going to be some of these costs that have benefits under both functions and other reliability functions, so some capacity and some energy delivery. And, you know, it may be fair to just say, hey, that other, breakdown that we had is not totally accurate, and we admit that, and so we could just say, well, let's try to make it as, fair as possible as far as just breaking it in half and saying we're going to do some under volumetric and some under the peak demand. Now, I know this may sound a bit, I don't know how to describe it, but it may be a bit less sophisticated than some folks think is appropriate, but this kind of methodology could still kind of reflect the benefits and the cost and cost drivers and benefits that customers are receiving in a way that may be still better than simply doing a volume metric. So, if folks have other ideas about this, but this is just my other thought, was since we were pretty close to 50-50 on that other idea, you said, well, what if we just said, okay, down the middle? So, any thoughts on that concept? Any thoughts on the let's go with the less accurate method? I don't think people are going to support that, but, you never know. No.
Hi, this is Bill of PG&E. I just think the only thing I was going to say is that as we kind of go through this, I think even if we were to start going with this kind of approximate approach, I think it would still be helpful to have analyzed the more data-driven approach, because even here, I think it seems you're kind of saying, well, the 50-50 is kind of close to what we got from the data, but we really need to do that data regardless to see if we do this, kind of hand-waving, that at least it represents roughly reality.
Right, because it could be very significantly different, as mentioned, with these other comments where, hey, maybe if you add in all those other reliability costs from the 4.10, then all of a sudden it doesn't look even close to 50-50, maybe 25-75 or something like that, right?
Yeah.
Certainly understand that. It's a good point. Thanks. I think we will try to do a more sophisticated job of doing that analysis and try to break down the costs more. So that's certainly something we got to do. All right. Can we go open up the line on the phone, operator? Thanks. Anyone on the phone? You may be muted, caller.
Good afternoon. This is Tanya Dorlin with the Office of Ratepayer Advocates. I was calling to find out if you had clarified if this new TAC rate structure would apply to transmission costs going forward, or is it for all costs today and going forward?
Thanks for the question. That's a good question. So the idea that we had initially was that we would just apply this to all the existing costs, and then it would also apply going forward to any of the additional costs that were incurred. So that was our initial thought, but as we had spoken about earlier in the point of measurement discussion, there may be a need to kind of revisit, hey, should we have some different treatment for maybe new costs or new investment going forward? And I think we're open to suggestions on that and exploring that concept a bit. It does tend to get complicated very quickly when you start trying to do that, but I think we do need to spend some time thinking about that and discussing it in our future proposals. So I appreciate the question.
Yes, because it seems that potentially the new costs going forward would be to serve later evening peak. So just something to consider, what we expect the new cost to be.
Yeah, and I think that would get captured under this idea of the peak demand. So we would say, okay, if the actual peak hour is, moving later into the evening, hopefully this using a peak demand, at least a portion of the TRR being collected under peak demand function would reflect that, as you measure those peaks and then see where the coincident peak lands and then look at the usage at that time. It should be able to reflect this, shifting peak, that happens a little bit later on in the day perhaps now. But there was some discussion in another workshop we talked about with as far as using the gross peak or the net peak. We have the whole duck curve thing that everybody loves to talk about. I think that's the first time I got to say it here in any ISO meeting. So that's interesting because we say it so often. But that's just an aside. But I think we do need to think about, internally we've talked about it, and we came down on we need to use the gross peak number, not the net peak, because that's really what you have to plan the system to. You're not planning the system to the net peak. You're planning the system to be sized to meet the gross peak. So that's the idea there. So maybe that doesn't quite capture what you were getting at on the phone there as far as capturing maybe the net peak issue. But certainly need to talk about it more. I think if you guys have ideas about that, let us know.
Thank you.
Thanks. Okay. Another caller? Okay.
Can we take the next caller, please?
Hi, this is Mike Benn from PowerX, and sorry, I've been on and off the call today, so if this has been addressed earlier, I apologize. I'm not sure if this is the best time to ask, but my question is, I was wondering, is this hybrid approach envisioned to apply for exports as well, so splitting between the volumetric and the capacity, basically, buckets?
Thanks for the question. No, we are excluding consideration of the exports under this tax structure initiative. We talked about that a bit in the scoping part of the proposal, if you want to go back through and read that, but it does explain that we're worried more about the cost allocation for the existing cost that was intended to meet internal load and not to adjust that exports aspect of this, which is currently volumetric. So, I appreciate the comment, but at this point we have deemed that out of scope for this initiative. You know, some folks had raised that should be revisited, and I don't think the ISO is opposed to talking about it and thinking about it, but at least for the purposes of this tax structure initiative and modifications right now, we are not considering doing that.
Okay, just like one follow-up question for that. So it sounds like for now that exports will remain volumetric, but if you do have two buckets of transmission revenue requirement for internal load, I'm just wondering how would that apply for the exports? So which bucket of the TRR would the exports be responsible for?
That's right. So I think what we would have to do is I may mischaracterize this because I'm not exactly sure about that, but my understanding would be we would likely just have to calculate a new wheeling access charge cost for that would reflect the overall TRR still, not the split breakdown that we have here. And I'm seeing people shaking their heads here, so in agreement with me. So that's the intent. So we wouldn't be somehow allocating some smaller proportion. And again, the idea essentially for exports is, and why we think it's important to focus on the internal loads and the embedded costs for the system for serving internal loads is that anything that we're collecting for the exports cost just goes to offset the cost that ratepayers pay internal to the ISO.
Okay, thanks for clarifying.
Sure. I'm going to go over here and then to Bert and then to you.
So then I'm David Oliver with the Navigant. So if you would create a wheeling access charge using the entire TRR, what would be the, and it would be on a megawatt hour, but where would those megawatt hours be measured? I mean, are they just the total sum of exports?
No, it would be based on the load forecast again.
So it would still be based
rate,
on the
just like we do today. Yep.
Okay, exactly like we do. Okay.
Sure.
Bert Anson, Southern California Edison. I heard a suggestion that there would be a different assessment with new versus existing components of the TRR, and I'd just like to go back to one of my earlier comments, which is splitting the TRR is not as simple as it sounds. That would basically create a TRR with four buckets, high voltage, low voltage, new, existing, and it is considerably complicated from a rate-making point of view.
Yeah, thanks for that, Bert. And, you know, just by doing this split here, we're already going to create four buckets like that, so or at least two more additional, or one more additional bucket, sorry, not for low voltage. I think, you know, that's important to note, but I do just want to say that we're open to the idea, as we had talked about earlier during the discussion about the point of measurement and during, you know, that my response to the woman from ORA, I think we're open to the idea of exploring that further, but you know, we want to make sure that, you know, we get feedback from stakeholders about how to do that. I think that it would be very complicated to try to do that. So you know, we definitely have to weigh that factor if we were going to go down that road. Bill, did you have?
Sure. This is Bill Peter with PG&E. Apologize if I used the wrong terms here, but I wanted to clarify something when you said that you're on the exports part for the wheeling charge, you're thinking of using the same structure. On a related topic, kind of the wheeling charge for internal, I think you referred to it as more like internal non-PTO type things. Is that, can you talk a little bit about that, and do you see that as
does that need to match the exports in your MCM structure, or could that potentially be changed as well here? Thanks.
Yeah, so here we go. I got a good slide for you on this one. So this is in our proposal as well. I'm just going to jump into it before I go back about the cost analysis stuff, because this is a very interesting discussion here. Now, the idea is, so we've explained that we don't want to change it the way we do it for the volumetric for the exports. But what we're putting out here today, and I know that some of the folks in the audience that are from the non-PTO Muni and MSSs, I'm looking over here at NCPA and CDWR and all these folks that are in that arena or that categorization, I think that they'll be very keenly interested in this, but we're just putting this out there as to stimulate discussion. We have no proposal on this at this time, but we want to think about if we need to revisit the approach for measuring the way we the use of the system for non-PTO munis and metered subsystems. Now, the idea is that, yes, we currently do this through the wheeling access charges, and we think that we may need to align this approach for measuring the use of the system for those entities with this new tax structure modification for a hybrid approach. And, you know, to do so, we would have to develop some kind of new category of rates for these entities where we split the wheeling access charge that's charged to them and then develop a component that's split, again, similar to how we would have to do it for the TRR for the traditional PTOs and UDC areas. So we want to seek feedback on this. We have not made a proposal, but we think that it's worthy of discussion. So with that, I'll open it up to thoughts and comments.
Robert Jenkins, Flint RCI. Just a clarification, you wouldn't be changing the point of measurement that you have today for these entities, it would just be changing the actual rate, correct?
Yeah, sorry. So let me clarify. In the proposal, and I didn't put this up on the slides, but we are not proposing to change the point of measurement for these entities. We are only saying we might need to revisit the measurement of use aspect for the billing determinant. So hopefully that answers your question, Bill. We're certainly interested in hearing what people think about this. Obviously, especially from those entities themselves. But one of the things we said in the proposal was that, look, we understand that these entities have developed their own systems and pay for all the embedded cost of their distribution system, but some of these areas are treated in the planning process similar to internal load. It looks like an internal load in our planning process, and we have to size the transmission system in a similar way, which lends itself to thinking, well, then if you unravel that thread a little bit more, should we now use a peak demand charge for them as well, because we're saying, hey, it might not make sense to continue the volumetric for everyone else, but does it make sense to do this for these other entities as well, because they have a different treatment right now. But in this instance, since they are similar to how we do it today, for the measurement of use, I think it makes sense to at least explore. So we'll look forward to getting people's feedback on that. Again, it will be a specific element that we ask for feedback on. Any other thoughts on that?
Sound like Clean Coalition. This is related to that and comes back to the question of the point of measurement. One of the things that stands out to me in this proposal, and again, we're supportive of considering demand charge factors in this, when we look at the impact and potential methods for mitigating a demand charge component for any of the UDCs, by continuing the existing point of measurement as a customer meter that we have for the PTOs, we'll see things like the 1,300 megawatts of energy storage that the IOUs are procuring. It's mostly in front of the meter that can be used to mitigate this, wouldn't actually mitigate, it wouldn't be measured by measuring at the customer level. Likewise, the procurements for the consideration in Moore Park and replacement of Parente and peaker plants, if that's being done through energy storage and other local DER, or the Oakland peaker replacement. Again, not all, but anything there that's in front of the meter that's being there to address that same peak demand facilities or to and that would reduce the peak demand on the coincident peak demand for the system if used that way, wouldn't be caught by measuring that at the end use customer meter. And that's a concern that applies to this as it has to the rest of it for us.
Yeah, so I think that I would agree with that description that we certainly think that that's accurate, that if we continue to use the point of measurement at the end-use customers, then it would not capture if there was DG in front of that was potentially reducing the peak demand charge or the peak demand on the transmission system. So something to try to address in the future, I think, we need to try to think about, is that appropriate or should that be the justification to change the point of measurement and make some of those complicated changes that we might need to do and try to justify some of that stuff. I'm not going to say that I think we haven't determined yes or no on, if we think that is needed under this new peak demand proposal or enough of a impact where we need to change it, but I think that's a valid point. So something to consider for our next proposal. And I hope we can try to at least address that to describe it more in depth in the next proposal for you guys. So go ahead.
Yeah. Sort of on a related note is this question of might be nice to put a question in the template to ask, particularly the IOUs, just off the top of your cuff, would there be any effort to try and mitigate these demand charges? Because it seems like the only way that could be done is behind the meter. And of course, there's maybe out of scope because I know we started off by saying we're not looking at how the incentive structure works and all that. But it might be when we're looking at, I suspect this is going to involve a pretty significant cost shift among the IO, the UDCs, and getting whether that's justified. It might be worth looking at how this plays out in terms of what the benefits of it are. Which I realize that analysis is still coming, but that would be great, interesting to hear the IOU take on, if we're living in a demand charge world, what kind of actions would that spur on their part?
Thanks for that comment. I think that's fair. I do want to try to, again, differentiate the real justification that we have for this proposal. So certainly understand that we included aspects about, hey, this could create signals to try to lower your demand charges that may help that. But we also note that, look, the high voltage TRR is a very small percentage of the overall cost that ultimate, end-use customers ultimately have to pay for. In comparison to the generation distribution cost, it's very small. It's like 10% or less. for all the transmission, then smaller for the HVTRR. So I don't think that this is intended to create a signal for people to lower their demand as much as it is intended to reflect the true cost drivers and benefits that are being received to the system. So that would be my response to that, but I certainly think that it's fair to say, hey, would this have any impact? Because we asked that about the idea of making incentive for DG. I think this is a similar type of a question that needs to be asked. So fair enough, and I think we do want to explore that. But really the main idea here was to try to better align the cost causation benefits of the use of the system now of the embedded costs rather than like trying to adjust the future behavior or send some signal to avoid some peak demand charges. So that's kind of how I'm thinking about it at this point. Any other questions? Okay, let me go back to this analysis piece. So this is going to be my last slide, then we're going to wrap up, so we might get some time back here. so as I had alluded to and mentioned a number of times earlier, we are trying to put together a spreadsheet model that allows us to analyze different approaches to the current track structure. We engage with Brattle Group and some folks that have worked with us previously on a number of you know, in very sophisticated modeling efforts to try to put together something that is really useful for stakeholders. Unfortunately, we didn't want to put it out for you guys to look at yet because we wanted to have this discussion based on principles. I'm driving that home very harsh and very strongly here because, you know, as soon as we put this thing out, I know that there are going to be parties that say, well, it's going to cost me more or totally against it. So, you know, it not talk about the actual principles of this. So we wanted to have a at least one chance to have meaningful feedback based on the principles and the merits of the proposal right now, which is why we decided it was not prudent to put the modeling out yet. But the goal of this will be to analyze the potential cost shifts of different approaches, and specifically we have the ability to look at the TD interface idea. We have the point of measurement change. We have the ability in the model to look at time of use, to look at volumetric, to look at the peak demand charges on a 1 CP, 4 CP, and 12 CP basis, and then a hybrid approach where you use part volumetric and part peak demand, which can again be 1, 4, or 12 CP. So those are the scenarios that we're able to analyze with this model. I'm sure that folks will be quite interested to take a look at it. We need to have discussions if we're going to provide just some results of our initial proposal for the next iteration, or if we're going to put out the model publicly and let people actually take that thing back to their shops and you know, toy around with it and monkey around and see what they want to do to use that to help their comments. But I think that it'll be certainly be interesting either way, whatever we ultimately end up doing, but we're thinking about that. And so, you know, if folks have strong opinions about wanting to see the model in their own hands and being able to use it themselves, please let us know that. We you know, obviously I think we assume that everybody does, but we do want to, you know, make sure it's transparent and open for all stakeholders as much as possible. So that's the intent on that and our, you know, ideas for the future on that one. So with that, I don't really have anything else for you guys today. Is there any final questions, comments, concerns? Bill, go ahead.
Yeah, this is Bill Peter with PG&E. Just kind of talking about the next steps a little bit and also the scope. So I think in the past, I think PG&E's been kind of suggesting that we try to keep the scope as broad out as possible. And it seems like this initiative is kind of clearly moving forward on just the point of measurement and the billing determinant. And I think, you know, I understand the desire to kind of get this done and all that. Can you just talk a little bit about kind of the broader tech reform, and do you see that if there are other issues that we think need to be addressed, what's the best way to get those addressed? So,
sure. Well, that's a fair question, and you know, I think a valid point. So, you know, I don't want to sound like we're, you know, talking out of both sides of our mouths, because we have said previously we want this to be holistic and we want to be, you know, have a broad scope. We try to do our best to answer some of those suggestions that stakeholders had in our scoping and in the response to the scope questions in the proposal itself. But yeah, I it's hard to answer exactly, you know, for all those broad questions, you know, what all the drivers were right now. I don't want to get into specifics, but the idea really is that we focused on these two major approaches or two major aspects of the TAC proposal because we think that those are essentially the biggest questions at hand and the most impactful for as far as trying to better align the cost causation and benefits with the actual cost allocation, which is what we keep hitting on. But you know, there are other things like that export idea that folks have brought up, and a number of other things. You know, there was suggestions about different parties you can allocate the cost to and things like that. And I think that the ISO isn't opposed to having future discussions on those things, but we're trying to again narrow the scope because of what you had mentioned. We're trying to get this proposal done and, you know, finalized so that we can have some actual outcome where we can implement something sooner than later. So there is, you know, not a particular pressing time issue here, but, you know, this whole initiative has been kind of an ongoing thing that's now taking quite a bit of time now, and that's really about all I can say at this point. But I would just note that we will track additional issues that need to be possibly addressed that maybe could be something more narrow, like maybe the exports issue or other changes that might need to be made in our initiative catalog where we track those stakeholder issues. And there may be other initiatives in the future that might have to deal with things like that. So, I know that we're ramping up a lot of discussions about EIM and how that might need to be looked at for some of the transmission costs in those areas, and that might be another opportunity to revisit some of these different issues, especially like the export thing and how that's treated. So that might not be totally responsive to your question, but that's about the best I can do for you right now at this point. Happy to have more discussions with you guys offline too. And again, if people have strong opinions about the feedback on the scoping of this, I'm certainly happy to try to respond again in our next iteration of the proposal if folks think that there's something that might be included here that we're deeming out of scope. So, any other comments, questions? Dan?
Well, I think you kind of alluded to it. There is one more slide in your package.
Oh yeah, that was the one we had just talked about earlier.
Yeah.
This was the Muni thing. So non-PTO Muni and MSS thing. I skip forward and then skip backwards. Yeah. So then there's the next steps, but go ahead.
Well, Ms. Jan, so I guess I remain, frankly, a little concerned about, sort of leaving that piece of it where it is while changing the rest of it.
Okay.
Because I think that raises some fairness issues.
Okay.
So, I guess my inclination at this point is I think we need to sort of get our arms around that piece of it at the same time we make changes that are going to affect the larger UDCs.
Yeah, and I think that we agree that, we have that discussion and see what the feedback is on this issue for the non-PTO munis and MSSs, because it does seem to, since we're doing it currently in a similar way, as far as at least the method we're using to measure the usage, then it may make sense to adjust it too. So, I think we're open to that.
And don't get me wrong, I'm not suggesting now is the time to load a bunch of additional transmission costs on these entities. That's not what I'm going after.
Sure.
But I'm looking more forward, and I just think the way we've got the system set up now, it's ripe for some mischief.
Mm.
I'm not saying anybody's going after this aggressively or anything, but it seems like now is the right time to address potential issues that could arise down the road.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I appreciate that, Jan. And we are certainly seeking feedback on that. We'll probably have a more significant write-up in our next proposal that explains our thinking on at least initially what we think we should do with that this issue. So thanks for that comment. All right. Anything on the phone? All right, so I'll turn it back over to Jody for our next steps. Thank you, everyone. Thank you.
All right, so this is just a reminder that all these comments that you guys have been talking about, please submit them in written form to the initiative's comments at kaiso.com by February 15th, and we'll have a template available for you shortly, posted up on that link. So with that, any additional questions about the timelines, anything? All right, well, thank you very much. Have a great day.